You decide again now.
Why? What have you done?
Because you weren't going to do that.
Yeah, I'm allowed to do whatever I want.
We're not going to pretend, but you're not going to also like.
Can that be the pre-roll?
Yes. I hate you so much.
Okay, I'll start again.
Now just wait. Now I'm getting it.
This is your fault, Jonathan. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. This is episode 21. We have Kirsten to my left and the surprise guest all the way from WA, the mine sites in WA, it's Jonathan Strahan. How are you, Jonathan?
I'm fine. And yourself?
It's great. How is it doing a podcast without Skype?
Really weird. I mean, yeah. Really weird. I have to tell you. I mean, the one time, well, the two times I've done it with Gary, I'm like, I'm looking at this guy's face going, why are you right in front of me? It's very distracting. I mean, usually I'm just staring out a window at my backyard, looking at this microphone, and that's it. So it's weird.
Yeah, well, you'll have to look at my face because you're sitting opposite from me.
Damn, I knew I drew a short straw.
Yeah, you did. And
you guys couldn't move around.
No, but see, this is my seat. This is my favourite seat.
He's very precious about his seat.
I take it back, sorry.
Yeah, because I get
upset. So I could move up the other end of the table.
You could, but it would be stupid.
Okay. Well, that would be the first thing stupid I've done, so.
Well, possibly. So, all right. And hello, Kirsten. I did introduce you, but I don't think you said anything.
Well, because you just moved straight on. Hello. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm well, then.
I moved straight on because it's important to get to the guest. So I wanted to ask you something. 104 episodes. Is it 104? Yeah. Except you keep going on about how there's
extras
and stuff, which is fine. So here's the thing that I want to know. Every so often, because it's a very, very good chemistry, bubbly sort of podcast, but every so often you'll say things, not critical, but just you'll note something like the Campbell Awards or like the encyclopedia and that. And for some reason, everyone gets the shits with you. Why?
Because I say stupid things.
No, but you don't necessarily. I remember with the SF Encyclopedia, you actually pointed out a really important thing, which is because it's an online website, you look at it once and you may never go back into it again unless you genuinely really need to. I don't think I've actually looked at it since it's been launched. Mm. I don't have a need. And people turn that into as if you said it was a worthless project. And
did they? Which,
yeah, absolutely. Ah.
People don't like it when you criticize what they're doing or when you – not even criticize, when you run – counter to the prevailing PR wind.
But I mean, that's what an encyclopedia is for, though. Like, you dip into it when you need to.
You're familiar with the website.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have to say, after the fact, having spoken with the people there and everything else, I know it's a major concern of theirs that people will not frequent the website because it's got to be – I mean, any website has to be promoted. Yep. Any web product has to be usable and accessible and all that kind of stuff. So those are major issues for that because – when you have a 1,200-page hardcover book sitting on your table, you pick it up and you flick through it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's happened since the second edition of the encyclopedia came out in like 1993 or 4 is Wikipedia and ISFDB and these sort of places.
Yeah.
So there's all these other research places that you're used to going to.
And they rank a lot higher when you...
So now what you've got to do is you've got to change the habits of all these people to get them to go and look at this other thing. Which along the way you're saying isn't the final one, it's a beta, we're changing it. So you're going, it kind of makes it less trustworthy in a way, less dependable because it's a beta.
Yeah, I guess you don't know that the information you go and look at today won't actually be and not change because things have changed, just because the entry has changed.
Now, I should say, in fairness to their product, that they have now made a change to it as a result of some other comments in this line, and they now put dates on each individual entry.
Yep.
So you know when you're looking at an old one, when you're looking at a new one.
Okay,
so that helps and it counteract.
Yeah.
And the encyclopedia itself is great. I mean, the really good stuff that's in there.
But why should I go look at it?
If you want to know about something about science fiction.
But I always go to Wikipedia. I mean, how do they – they're going to probably win a Hugo this year. They've got to be odds on favourite to win that category.
They've got a good chance.
Yeah, odds on favourite. That's all I'm going to say.
but it's the only time they can ever win.
Yeah, I understand that. But so they'll win a Hugo. They'll get that prize. I'm sorry, I don't mean to drag you back into this debate because you've already been – but this shattered me that you got attacked for this because it's a really good thing, it's a good point, which is why should I – the general – I'm a big SF geek. Why should I go there? I use Wikipedia. Wikipedia does what I need. Is it 100% accurate? Probably not. But how are they going to move me along?
I'll tell you why. First of all, probably because you'll get a broader variety of detail in different science fictional subjects. And second of all, and this is something I'm yet to experience fully – But they, the argument goes, they've put all these links across between various things in the encyclopedia, and it links up to more knowledge and gives you a broader scope in things. And that's the argument for doing it, right?
So okay. that you, so, will, so you go there and like, you'll go there, you look at one thing, and then you spend something else. Day.
And there's all this sort of lateral linking. And certainly John Clute, when he talks about it, talks very much about the importance of hyperlinking to the encyclopedia. And I will take his word for it because he's John Clute and he's smarter than I am.
Yes. Right? And I agree that he is.
Yeah, thank you very much. I guess to get around to your point, I'm not entirely sure because it makes me sound like an egotistical, rude word, but this is a good podcast, so I can't say it.
It's not.
Okay, it makes me sound like an egotistical wanker if I say, for whatever reason, I have enough profile that if I say not the right thing, people get annoyed.
Well, I was going to say, there is this profile issue, isn't there?
I guess there is. I mean, when I commented on the encyclopedia, some of them were unhappy. I got requests for right of reply podcast and all this kind of stuff. And
wow,
I know that when I years ago when Orbit Australia was founded,
yep.
and I made a comment on the Articulate blog about what I thought the impact of Orbit Australia would be, that was taken very poorly within Orbit, and it was made clear to me subsequently it was taken very poorly, and I was very surprised because I thought I'd made, in my own foolishness, a very balanced and reasonable sort of assessment yep. of the circumstances. And you know, but sometimes it's bad, and sometimes you just have to sort of suck it up, sunshine, and allow that if you're going to go out and talk with the rest of the world, they get to talk back.
Oh, yeah, I get that, but they seem to. I get the feeling that because if you're being outspoken and just absolutely critical, what you said and what the response was did not equate, is what I'm trying to say. Same with the Campbell Awards, and you're probably a bit harsher on the Campbell. Forget the gender stuff that was mentioned by Gary, because I know that was a separate issue. I'm just talking about the 9 men, 2 women. Was it out of the 11?
Yeah, that's what it is, 9-2.
And it was a fair comment. It's a fucking fact. It's there. It can't be debated. And I saw on, I think it was on the comments on your thing. No, it was on Cheryl's.
Mm.
On Cheryl Morgan's thing, there's a lot of people, the judges defending it, which is fine, but again, sort of having that sort of, how dare you, Jonathan, I'm special.
In fairness, the key there was, with the best intention in the world, Cheryl phrased her summary in such a way that it implied that Gary had agreed that women didn't write hard science fiction. Yes. Now, that's not what he said. And it's not what Cheryl intended, and she was very clear about it subsequently.
Yeah.
But that particular wording caused that problem. And then there was a tweet where she tweeted it. Then I think Elisa Krasnostein, our dear friend, came in and was like, oh, well, what are they up to now?
Yeah.
And I was a bit like, well, hang on, we're friends. Don't I get a little bit more slack than that?
Yeah.
But you don't, because it's the 21st century and gender is the only topic we have, and you get kicked. if you have ghoulies, you get kicked in them. And that was fine, you know, but – It wasn't.
But that wasn't. No, but that's something I'm. It was the 9 out of 2 comment that you made that also got a bit of.
I didn't go back and look.
Oh, okay. You missed it then.
No, I didn't miss it. I just didn't see it.
Very clever. No, there's a lot of defending of. But again, they weren't attacking you. They were just
I think
a lot of back knee jerk.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of. There are a lot of. I'm going to be very diplomatic here. There are a lot of people in. The community, and I'm actually not thinking of anyone in particular. This
yes,
is a no, I'm really not. This She's is a complete generalization, but there are a lot of people who don't react well to criticism of the community from within the community. There's this idea that if we're all in the community and there's enough out there people in the mainstream world who don't like us, we shouldn't be criticizing ourselves because there's going to be enough people criticizing us, so we should all just be rah 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 and having each other's back and not, which yeah. I don't subscribe to, but there are a lot of people yeah. it seems who have that attitude.
And the other thing is that, again, sounding like an egotistical wanker, I have a gatekeeper role.
I was going to ask that. Now, do you see yourself as having a gatekeeper role?
No, because I never think about it. But I have to acknowledge that I'm the reviews editor for Locus.
Yep.
So I've got a lot of influence, at least in what they do or don't do. I mean, I've got other people I work with there and other people who make decisions, but I have influence. I do the year's best.
Yep.
I do this and that. And all of that amounts to, even if it's not something that I ever think about consciously on a day-to-day basis, it's there. And none of us really know how we're perceived by other people.
Yeah.
And so I don't think about it. I'm just some person, to my own mind, just talking to my friend on the podcast or whatever else, shooting my mouth off. And somebody else is saying, well, there's this person who they've never met who's this middle-aged white guy who has a gatekeeper role, and maybe he should just shut up.
Jonathan, I shoot my mouth off. I speak shit.
You're not a gatekeeper.
You, yeah, no, no, wait a sec. That's not the thing, point I was going to make. I know when someone is shooting their mouth off because I do it all the time. You should see me at work. You do not. Yes, I know it's not a structured podcast, Coot Street, but you're actually not only articulate. I can't believe I'm praising you. You're not only articulate, but you're also very careful in what you say. And you know, you don't just speak. And the same with Gary. And so when you and it shits me because it's a really good podcast. I love it. I've listened to every episode. I have. That's the truth.
Thank you. That's I've listened to, but thank you.
Yeah. and I think that there's got to, people have got to give you guys the ability to say what you think, even if it's not necessarily positive, because if it's just constant positivity, I would have stopped listening a long time ago.
Yeah, but okay, I'll play devil's advocate a little bit because the dialogue back can be really valuable.
Yes.
Sometimes we make mistakes.
I get that.
And sometimes it's valid. I mean, I actually think in retrospect I ranted too much about the Campbell. The 9-2 thing is worth pointing out, but honestly the least interesting thing in the whole subject of gender in science fiction is the numbers of it. Mm. Honestly, who cares about the number of people in a book or not, on an award ballot or not? The issue is about awareness and accessibility and consideration and thought and all this kind of stuff. Those are the real issues. The fact that Bill Smith or Mary Jones does a book with 11-3 or 8-4, who gives a crap? It doesn't matter. What matters is that people are being inclusive and thoughtful and everybody has an equal chance to be involved in our field.
Yeah, that's right.
So me ranting a little bit at a bunch of old guys picking out novels – is, you know, my first reaction to the list wasn't actually the 9-2 thing. It was, gosh, that's not the list I would have picked because I'm an egotistical wanker. And then I kind of went, and there's an awful lot of guys. And they went, and actually counted up. And they went, oh, 9-2, that's terrible. Rant. While someone thinking, shut up, move on. And I mean, in fairness, the same group of people picked the Sturgeon list.
Yep.
And that's much better gender balanced.
Yep. Yeah, you weren't making the claim, though, that they're sexist, et cetera. You were just saying there's got to be more. And it was a really good question asked. There's got to be more than two science fiction books out there written by women this year that are worth being put on this list. That was a discussion that's worth having. That's not what it becomes, unfortunately. It becomes, how dare you say that I'm sexist. Not that that was what was said on Cheryl's blog, but that's what the discussion becomes. And I don't know. I get frustrated. But I just think you deserve the ability, gatekeeper or not, influence or not, I don't think you're going to destroy anyone's career because you're not the sort of person that's going to go out and say.
I mean, like, let's be realistic. I couldn't destroy somebody's career even if I wanted to. If I sat there and went, I'm going to go after person X, what am I going to do? I mean, seriously, first of all, I work with Liza Trombi at Locus. If I did that, she'd say, you need to just get back in your little box. We're going to be reviewing the books, as she should do if they need to be reviewed. So that's not going to happen. And I may not choose them for my year's best. Well, it's not like it's the only one. And if I start making egregiously poor decisions and omitting somebody, someone's going to go, you're being a dick. And they'd be right.
And as Mike Resnick would point out, he's nominated on a Hugo shortlist, which I don't think he appeared in any of the year's best.
No.
So there you go. And same with the Scalzi.
Sure.
Didn't appear in any of the – see, you don't even need year's best because
– And I mean, I have to be careful because I take it all too personally. The whole Eclipse thing a couple of years back, that was an individual, emotional, personal nightmare.
Yeah, you were attacked viciously.
And so some
people would say for good reason.
Whatever. I mean, there's all kinds of background stuff and contextual stuff to that.
Of course.
But I kind of went, okay, you learn, you move on. And yes, I keep saying stuff. Yes, it seems that sometimes you get a disproportionate response and sometimes from what you think are friendly quarters.
Yeah.
But that's life. Sorry.
It's okay. Just move the microphone.
One of the things you've got to know, Jonathan, is that when Kirsten does one of the little things, which is either moving the microphone or screaming at you in a whisper.
Don't say anything?
Don't say anything.
Sorry.
Apparently it's not professional.
Okay.
And
haven't you listened to my podcast?
Yeah. But that's the cuteness of it. It's
maybe
cute.
I'll leave that in now.
Yeah, so you've noted it as a possible edit. You're such a – and now that we're still talking about it, minutes later, you're stuck. You're
that's okay. Everything. There's 2.5 hours to run down. We can catch up with those Galactic Suburbia girls without a problem.
Oh, I was going
to
say, by the way, this podcast is going to go longer than 1 hour and 10.
Yeah,
which is what you seem to have got it down to.
I have a thing where I've said to Gary, I want to change it to the Coot Street Hour.
Yeah, well, you nearly get it to exactly an hour.
I actually have a timer running in front of me on my desktop, and as close as I get to an hour, it's like, that's time to wind up now.
Yeah.
Even if we're in the middle of conversation. And that's just my thing. I'm not going to say it's critical of anybody else.
It's easy when you've got fuck all structure and you can just say, well, Gary's been talking 3 minutes on another dead person from the 1940s that no one gives a shit about. And he's possibly also mentioning the voyage to Arcturus for about the 405th time an hour. Was it his brother bought him a copy that then it's worth a bazillion? He said that story. Gary, you've said that story now I think 5 times, although he won't listen to this, so it doesn't matter. So it's that easy. You just have to turn around and go, Gary, yeah, waffle time. Oh, is that all? Oh, all right, we'll stop now. Done. Whereas here, I can't do that to Kirsten. When she's talking shit, I've got to allow her to do it because we know we're reviewing books and that.
Yeah.
When I'm talking
Vicky Verka.
Shit.
Or Vicky Verka. Sometimes I talk shit.
Yeah, really. But the problem is as well, I mean, with the freeform structure, sometimes you sit there. I mean, you made a comment about when we were coming here about the podcast with Michael Dieter.
Yes.
And how I seem to go missing.
You finished 60 minutes.
And it's like, well, it was 6 o'clock in the morning and I hadn't slept much. I've never met Michael Dieter. I hadn't read anything that he was talking about pretty much. So I'm going like, Gary seemed to be carrying it perfectly well.
And, you know, Gary didn't seem to note that you hadn't said anything. It was brilliant. There was no point where Gary stopped and thought, shit, Jonathan hasn't said anything for half an hour. Jonathan, you got a thought on this? And, you know, it was nothing. It just kept on going.
Yeah.
It was just him and Dieter talking.
Gary knows far more than I do. And so I'm quite happy to let him do the heavy lifting a lot of the time.
It was brilliant. I was laughing. It was a great conversation, I've got to say. The Dieter episode's fantastic. And in fact, I've bought the book, the one the Holmes one that won the Poe or whatever it won. And Dieter was fascinating. And Gary, as you're right, knows him well. And fantastic bunch of questions. But I couldn't help but think, where's Jonathan? Say something, for Christ's sake.
Well, I must say there was a moment where I thought, I could probably get up, go out, make a cup of coffee, go to the bathroom, play with the kids, do something.
The moment you do that is the moment Gary says, what do you think, Jonathan?
Except, you know he won't, though. Gary doesn't listen this far in. I don't think he listens to The Writer and the Critic, Gary. So
I don't. I think he may have, yeah. Because I praise it to him.
You're in trouble now.
Oh, I love Gary.
Oh, really, you say that seriously.
Now he says it, doesn't
he? No, I
but
do.
You should have heard the bit I just cut out, Gary. It's terrible.
The only thing that's really weird is because we don't think about it. Other people listen to it and they do. And they'll come back and say, in episode 88, when you talked about Michael Dieter, what did you mean? And you're going, I have no clue what you're talking about. I mean, it's honestly, it's like, I'm like, my brain is like an Etch-a-Sketch, right? And at like 10:30 a.m. it goes, shroom, and it's blank again.
It's funny, in my head I always think I've rambled or said a lot, not articulated things as well as I thought. And I go back and listen to it and think, all that stuff that I thought I said, that just all stayed in my head. Really good.
No, I'll say, whilst he's like sort of, you know, the comedy, you're really coherent on the podcast. Really,
thank you.
Smart and really clear. It's really good.
I suppose I am the comedy.
You are. You're the comic relief, just as you know.
That's about all I provide.
You're SpongeBob.
Yes.
No, you. What did one of our listeners say? You're the everyman or something. I can't remember. I think it was Sean was tweeting about you being
the everyman.
You taking it for the
team. You're taking it for the team.
Yeah.
Well, because I asked the 101 questions or whatever.
Yeah.
So the questions that everyone's thinking but are too afraid to ask because they think they'll come off as an idiot.
Yeah.
Apparently, I've got no shame.
And somehow you never get flamed for it.
No, because people know that I don't entirely mean
it. Oh.
Well, no, I don't. No, it's not about me. It's about Jonathan. That's what I'm talking about.
I can tell you why he doesn't get flamed for it. Because they come across as very genuine.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Well, they are mostly.
But, I mean, that's the difference. It's not arch. It's not mannered. It's not just being clever. And it's and also, the other thing that makes it okay, not to say it all complimentary back at you, but is that there's a learning process going on.
Yeah.
As you said yourself.
Yeah.
If you're just... You're also not being a pig about it. I mean, if you ask pig-type questions, but you're asking them in a context, that's not the same as being the pig.
Yeah.
So you're asking, these questions that are worth asking that end up with interesting topics of conversation that flow on from them.
Yeah, because aside from being Jewish, I hit every other marker, which is I'm white, middle class.
See, I just hit them all.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, and so I do have these and the fact that I am Jewish, and as Elisa will admit, it's a very patriarchal religion, there's a lot of that gender stuff going on there too. So these are questions that, you know, I would never have asked.
They're good questions.
And that's why Galactic Suburbia, I'm very happy that they won the convener thingamajig award, because they have changed the face of well, thinking and podcasting, but not the fuck the podcasting. They've changed the face of gender chat in Australia.
Oh, they undoubtedly have.
In my opinion.
I would go further than that. I would say that in 2012, the number one topic of conversation in the science fiction field, at least in the social media online environment, is gender.
Yes.
And they have played an instrumental role in that.
Absolutely.
The challenge for them and for us is to move the dialogue on to something more substantial now in that same area, but that's very much what they've done, and we owe them a great vote of gratitude for it.
Yeah. And, I mean, you guys as well, because, I mean, you started before them or?
Around the same time, I'd have to go back and look around then.
Yeah. That would mean having to go back.
It was
back.
2 years ago.
Yeah, I know. But you were doing it. You're doing it differently, but you started chatting about the canon. That was the first bunch of podcasts. Mm. I was like, oh, fuck, I can't believe I remember this. That's how much it's itched in my brain. No, you did. You were talking about Joanna Russ very early on, about the canon and canon forming, and all that stuff also had an impact because it was two white guys and two white guys probably because, you know, you're not young, Jonathan. I don't want to break the news.
Oh, you're so rude.
And Gary's younger, but not by much. I see what I did there. So you're very much set in your ways, but yet you were questioning those things yourself.
Sure. Well, I mean, for me, the whole online discussion post-dated the Eclipse discussion.
Ah, yes.
And the Eclipse discussion was the real kick in the head. Yeah. And I had to realize a few things that I'd not considered about who felt invested in what actions and all this kind of thing. I mean, the key thing with Eclipse that made it such an issue was a particular community felt they had a stake in it, and I had no idea they felt they had a stake in it. And so when the book didn't amount to what they expected, they were appalled. And then the people I was working with handled that reaction very poorly, and I felt that I had behaved appropriately at the time, but there was a lot of criticism, and then I became offended, and then it spirals into that kind of crap that it spirals into. And it just got really horrid, and then we moved past it. You know, you sit there and go, okay, well, fair enough. I can listen to that, and I understand now you feel invested in my book. When I thought, see, when you do your book, and you would know this, it's different, but there'll be something similar. When you do your novel, right, that's Kirsten's novel, right?
Yes.
It sits in your head, in your house, it's yours. When I do an anthology, I'm not sitting there going, Eclipse belongs to all those nice people at WISCON who've had it sold to them, have been talked to with the publisher, they know the guy, he's a friend of theirs, all that kind of stuff. For me, it's a book I'm doing for me because I think it's cool at my house. And when I put it out, I've not really thought, because I'm stupid, right? I don't sit there when I do something and go through all of the stuff. I really just do it for myself.
Yeah.
And so then it goes out and they go, well, you didn't take me into account. And I'm going, who are you and why do you have a stake in this? And someone goes, well, there's this and there's this. And you're going, yeah, fine, I see, and all right. And nobody wants to allow, what, for whatever reason, that I had a stake in it. So it's just like I was wrong and the publisher was wrong. And the publisher did not really handle it well either, in ways that still mystify me and whatever. But it took a while to get through it and we fixed it up. We did Eclipse 3. That was the rebalancing of the ship book.
Yeah, you know? But... I don't want to get too stuck on Eclipse, but how much of that was that you felt you had to do a 50-50?
Not at all. I've never done that.
Okay.
Forget that. I wouldn't do that. That's offensive to everybody, isn't it? I mean, seriously, who wants to be?
Oh, absolutely.
Had I decided to change my process? Yes. But was it to create 50-50? No. It was just a case of I will now be aware. And then because I like to read a particular variety of stuff. That gets reflected in the way the book comes together as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
did Last Short Story come on around about that time too? Were they around Eclipse? They weren't around during Eclipse too, were they?
I don't remember.
I don't think
it's all a blur, mate.
Long ago.
Come on, Jonathan. Chris, you should have a history of this all written down.
It's probably 3 or 4 years' worth of Not a Few of the Last Short Story. They did it before I came along.
The hilarity is that anyone can check it up on the internet in 15 seconds.
My guess is, it was around when Eclipse happened, And I'm sure Eclipse 1 and 2 weren't really their book, would be my guess.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's been a help, though, Last Short Story to...
Yes, sure.
For the year's best and all those. Not for the... Because Eclipse is different, though, anyway, isn't it? Because you go and commission
there's
stories.
There's no doubt that... Last Short Story, and just for those out there who are listening to this who may not be aware of it, it's a particular group of people. It does overlap the Galactic Suburbia crew very heavily.
And me.
And you. But back then, it was, I mean, Tansy, Alex and Lisa were all involved.
And Ben.
And Ben, yep.
Yep.
Ben and so I take the views of the people in Last Short Story very seriously. And so if they're saying this is great, if I thought it was rubbish and they thought it was great, I'll go back and look at it again.
Yep.
Because I figured they're smart people. I respect them. And so what's happening, is it balances my taste a little bit? But I don't think that's a bad thing either. I mean, to have somebody else coming along and go, maybe you could pay attention to this a bit, or you were just a little bit quick in dismissing this. Because one of the things that happens is when there's such a volume of work to consider, you have to evolve shortcuts and ways of handling things.
Yep.
And you can read three bad things by somebody, and you'd see this with You read three things you don't like, you don't care about the fourth, fifth, sixth, or seventh thing.
Yep.
And so you need somebody else to come along and go, well, actually, item eight was really very good, and you're making a mistake. I mean, sometimes I go, I look and I go, no, I still think you're full of it. Hmm. But sometimes, you know, I go back and go, yeah, no, that's fair enough. And so Last Short Stories influenced me, what I've done a lot. The Eclipse discussion influenced me a lot. And some of the online debates, listening to Galactic Suburbia and everybody else, and the fact that this whole discussion going on has been a very healthy thing.
Yeah.
I'd be very surprised at anybody who really could make a point that it hasn't been.
Sorry, I'm hijacking the interview here. Sorry. Did you want to ask something, Kirsten?
No, actually, I was going to suggest that we've been talking for almost half an hour.
Oh, no.
See, this is what happens, Jonathan. This is why the podcast goes for fucking ever, all right? Because we get into a really good discussion. There's a whole bunch of other things I'd love to ask you that won't embarrass you in front of people.
But we're not going to.
No, because apparently we're going to
move on.
There is a small part of me that thinks, fuck the books, let's just do talk. But no, he's put in a lot of work reading them.
No. Yeah, I think Jonathan might hit you over the head with his iPad if you suggest
that. No, I'm good with it. It's been an interesting thing because the one thing you'll be surprised to know that I never do.
Is read?
No.
Is reread?
Well, that book that you're holding in your hand is the first book I've reread in 10 years.
Uh-huh.
So that's the first thing.
Yes.
But I don't get to talk to anybody about books at all, ever.
I really like talking. I don't.
That's interesting. Okay.
I don't review a lot of books. I don't write a lot of reviews anymore because it takes me a long time to put words down on paper. So this, talking about them on the podcast is fantastic. I would spend maybe a quarter of the time, even with all the post production, everything else, doing these reviews than I would if I actually tried to write one. At the length that I talk about them on the podcast. So it's really, really good.
Yeah.
I said a similar thing in my snapshot. No, I just want to say that this has really helped me talk about books. I do want to go back to writing reviews again, but this has really filled that need.
Yeah.
So. I don't know. One of the joys in my life is that I haven't written a book review in 10 years.
Yeah,
I really got to. I hated it
a little bit. I forgot. Yeah, that's another question I'd ask you about, because you used to be a book reviewer.
I think probably the reason also I stopped writing reviews, and not that I ever wrote heaps of them, but is I don't like the 4 to 5 paragraph book review. I don't like that. I don't generally read them. I don't find I get a lot out of them. What I like is sort of the essay length discussion type review of a book, usually with spoilers, because when you get to that length, you've got to actually be talking about stuff that's
and anything substantial involves.
Yeah, so and those I just don't have time to sit down and do very often. So, and I probably won't now that I'm doing this podcast, because they're all going on here.
Well, it is one of those things where when you've talked about it, and it's that classic thing they say to writers as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you have an idea, don't tell it to somebody, write it down, because otherwise you'll never write it.
Yeah.
And with this kind of thing, once you've done it, it's done, and then it's like, even if you remember what you wanted to say, it's gone.
In fact, I've taken to going on Goodreads, because I resurrected my Goodreads account, because I did actually want to keep a track of what I was reading. And for books that I've podcasted, I've just put a link in there. If you want to hear what I think, listen to this. I'm not writing.
No, that's
I might give
enough.
Like a one line kind of
thing. So you're going to segue?
I will segue. Oh, we're going to segue to the book Jonathan recommended for us, which is, Jonathan?
Galveston by Sean Stewart.
Tell us a bit about the book, Jonathan.
Oh, God, now I've got to read it. Basically, Galveston is a book that came out in 2000. I was on the crowd, World Fantasy jury that gave it the World Fantasy Award. It's the story of a young man whose family runs out of luck. His life falls apart. He's living in Galveston in about 2004-5. It's inundated by magic. The magic world is held separate from the realist world. And it's how his life intersects with the people around him, how he carries the injuries that he's experienced emotionally with him, and how that distorts his life, and how the woman that he'd known as a child has had her life restructured by the same things, particularly when you reach a key point in the book and it all is mixed together and flooded and it all explodes in a completely different change. Does that sound like it?
Yeah.
We should get Jonathan to tell us about all the books.
Correct. We should just read the back of the
That's
book.
That's probably the best
in a really bad monotone. Yeah, that was pretty fucking awesome.
It's like,
yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. We'll just Skype you in every month and say, Jonathan, tell people about these books.
Well, that basically summed up what I wanted to say, and it wasn't even a critique. So you gave it the World Fantasy Award.
I did.
Well, you didn't personally. Well,
you were on the jury.
The jury did. It's an interesting book. No, I have to say, I love Mockingbird. I've read Mockingbird. Mockingbird, and actually, if I ever get the opportunity to reread.
Which is the novel before this
one?
Is this the last or second last thing he wrote? Because I know he's still alive and he's doing games and stuff.
Basically, he wrote Mockingbird, which is a terrific book. Then he wrote this, which won the World Fantasy Award. Then he rewrote Perfect Circle,
which
is a spectacular book. Or at least I remember it, and this is a key thing with this discussion. Mm-hmm. And then he wrote a Yoda novel, and then he went off and did I Heart Bees and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, okay. So we're unlikely to ever get him back into the genre.
I was tweeting with Maureen McHugh, who works with him on all the gaming stuff.
Okay.
And she says there's some chance he may write again, but it's been a long time. It's because he's been very, very significantly successful with the gaming stuff or his gaming-related kind of things that he does. Yeah.
I'm going to be clear here. I did not dislike this book. I just found it a bit muddled. That was my problem with it. It's an odd book in that it's got the magic stuff. Well, there's a couple of things. Please feel free to interrupt.
Yeah.
Because that would never have stopped
you. No.
I didn't get the world building entirely clear. It's all set in Galveston, obviously, title of the book, and I got a lot out of Galveston, but it never got clear about the world outside of Galveston.
No, it never talks about how.
Like, what happened to Australia and New York? I mean, there's one mention later on the book about New York.
It does imply that, I mean, this has happened everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you see, what I didn't get is
so it's been a worldwide flood of magic,
and I don't want to get caught on this, but they're still using money.
Yeah,
that I didn't make just my. I know
that never bothered me. Never even occurred to me to be worried about that. I mean, I looked at it. I guess.
But wait a minute. It didn't occur to you, but is it a problem?
No.
Well, how do they have a monetary system?
It's a magical system.
Their economy seems to only be within Galveston. They're not trading outside of Galveston, so they have nominally decided to retain. The currency change, system.
Yeah, but you see, this is my biggest problem with the book. And it's a book about class, I get it, and class system. And the way that he's been able – and it's a really clever book about class system, and that's what I liked about it. But one of the ways he's pushed that class boundary between the haves and haves not is by having money still in the system, because the people who are the haves – they create their lovely guilds and whatever they're called, those groups.
Yeah.
Well, they're already created, but they entrench them, and they use money and property as a means of keeping above the have-nots, who use barter, who use trade goods and services. And that's what I was a bit confused about, because I would have thought you'd just overthrow the whole bloody money system, because who the fuck – I mean, money is only the money we give to each other is just a consensus thing. We all just think it's a word
And they've kept the consensus.
Yeah, but all you need is all those people. Sorry, Jonathan.
Don't you think we're more creatures of habit than that?
Oh, yeah, but you've just had a big fucking tsunami of magic.
But it's not as though it's just like some people in Galveston have some money and therefore they're still on top. They're not. They, as you say, they've got the nice houses, they've got the resources and the property and all the stuff.
I guess something we should make
clear
for a second
to –
to someone who's listening is that for a good chunk of the novel, Galveston is divided clearly in half.
Yeah.
Yes.
There is the carnival, which is happening down by the water, and it's the magical world where Momus – the god of the moon, whatever it is the god of carnival is ruling.
And anyone who's been touched too much by the magic
has gone to cruise, right?
Gets sent over to Mardi Gras.
And they're gone, and they never come back, basically. And then you have this group who are trying to keep the world as much as like it was before the war.
Which
before
I think includes the flood. The money.
Which includes money and the social structures and all that kind of thing. And there are people, and the lead character, Jake, is it?
Yes.
Yeah. Jake, sorry, I'm going to blank off for a second. Jake has all this invested in it because, I mean, after all, his whole sense of worth is his loss of class. This is why he can befriend
Ham.
Ham? Isn't this terrible? It's how long ago since I reread it, in fact. He befriends Ham and thinks he's – but still treats him like rubbish.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he's crushed when he finds out that Ham's been paid to be his friend.
Yeah.
And that everybody hates him.
And everybody hates him.
Which was actually a brilliant – it was a brilliant scene there.
Yeah. And you have this feeling that every, I mean, how would you feel if suddenly you realized everybody hated you? And then you realize it's because you actually were a dick.
Yeah.
And arguably the greatest, one of the greatest moments in the book is that he realizes actually that he was wrong and can suddenly see that all these people who are living their lives as best they can, that he's been judging as being lesser than he was, and not because he still wants to see himself up on the you know, up in the sort of the glorious houses up on the hill kind of a deal, that he's completely wrong.
Okay. And I found
that he's humbled, and the humbling is a really powerful thing.
I found it absolutely fascinating because at least in my experience of the book, as a reader, because you're with this character from the beginning and from when he was a small boy as well. So it's third person, and there's a little bit of, I can't really remember if there's a lot of stuff, but I think mostly it's inside Jake's head. So you're with him, you're going along with him. So what he thinks, what he feels, that's what you get. And it's not really, at least for me, it wasn't really until that moment in the court where he's on trial and you've got all these other people coming forward and saying what they actually think about him and their side of things that happen, that you realize that he is a dick.
Yeah,
and
he really
you
is.
Didn't think he was a dick.
Because you live with him through the crippled injustice. Yeah. And you're going, they're all being horrible to him.
And then the stories come out and you go, yeah, you're actually a dick.
And the thing is, like, I'm basically, he takes on the role of basically a pharmacist and almost a doctor to this poor community, which you think would make him beloved of them because he's helping.
But he's really resentful of them.
He's resentful and he's afraid of the responsibility of what he's doing. I mean, there's a point, I think, where he refers back to an instance where a child had died. And really what he should have done is have stayed and just offered sympathy.
That was in the court case.
Through this terrible experience. And instead what he does is basically, I came to help you, basically piss off.
Yeah.
And it was really horrid, but it's really powerful and really interesting that Stuart has chosen to show us the way that turns on itself.
Yeah.
And how all this stuff, which wasn't, I mean, yes, he was a victim. Yes, a terrible thing happened, but that doesn't mean that all the rest of the world is terrible. And that's what he lost track of.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And even the experience where they go after the cannibals and all that kind of stuff, and he has to reevaluate the relationship with Ham and all that kind of stuff and come back changed, which is that great kind of, I guess, going off into the wilderness kind of a deal, really shows you how he changed. And Stuart handles it really well.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it balances against what happens with
Sloan
Gardner, who is this very prim, proper woman who helps her mother, who's the leader of non-magical Galveston, and who then goes to cruise herself, which is this expression for going to the magical part of it, and becomes this wild, wanton version of herself that she's obviously always wanted to be. And that change and that growing self-awareness balances against what he's got happening.
Yeah, and if I was Sean Stuart, I'd say to me, you're a fuckwit, and it's not about the money and the economic system. In fact, you've missed the point. The point is that in an attempt to keep the magic at bay, they've actually specifically picked a system of the old times rather than go to barter, because if they were to go to a different system, they'd all be afraid that would somehow
the whole
ending is about the lower class realizing, shit, we actually do have a say in all this.
Hmm.
And actually, yes, there are these systems in place that are a bit fucked. And now that magic is basically, because this is spoilers, obviously, magic has basically flooded the whole town. Mm. Why should we hold back and not be part of this?
Sure.
So, Ian, you are a fuckwit for not knowing. and you're right. It's turning that. Yeah. It's a beautiful way of how it turns on Josh's arc and how Stuart doesn't then allow Josh to get the girl and save the day. He does actually save the day, though.
Yeah.
But even by saving the day, he's still not loved and they're not putting him up.
He's going to still have to earn any position that he gets in the community later on. He doesn't get any free passes, and that strengthens the book a lot.
Yeah, I think I really did like how that whole sequence when Jake and Ham get exiled.
I think that's the best part of the book.
And Ham finally blows up at him and tells him a few home truths and everything, and Jake sort of realizes a few things about himself. Even up to the very end of the book, Ham has still not, like, he hasn't just
magically
given him,
and,
it's like it was a real fissure in the relationship, and it's not something that you know, when Jake comes back and says, oh, I was wrong, I was a dick, I'm sorry, Ham isn't just going to go, oh, that's okay.
No, he's like, I don't care. Why would I care?
It's like, I've written you off now. Yeah.
And that relationship.
There's a begrudging thing at the end. They do. He has that because he has in a sense, saved the lower.
But also what happens is the exact opposite, since we're giving it all away, of what you expect.
Yes.
What you expect is that, I mean, from the prologue to the end of the book, you're sitting there going, at some point, surely, you know, boy gets girl, boy loses girl. Boy's going to get girl back, right? That's the deal. And he doesn't.
And he doesn't. Yeah.
And in fact, the nicer guy gets the girl, because Ham is far nicer than Josh ever is.
Yes, by a country mile.
I mean, you really warm to Ham.
And that's during the and when they're exiled. Yeah. That's when that really hits. What a great bloke Ham is.
Yeah.
And that actually, I was wondering, just you as an editor, that section when they are when they've been exiled and they're off on the coasts of somewhere. There's no magic in that.
Mm-hmm.
It's, in fact, feels like a separate book altogether, that section of their survival. I mean, you could top and tail it, beginning and end.
And make it a short story.
Or a novella, yeah. I love that bit, especially when the hurricane or whatever, tornado hits, and how they survive and all that shit, and then the two people come and, brilliant. I do wonder, though, whether it fits in the book, because it's got nothing to do with – there's very little reference to Momus. In fact, Momus barely disappears, and the whole carnival disappears from about that point until we get back to Galveston in the last third.
I think it's actually a critical part of the book.
It is a critical part of the book.
No. But I think structurally it's a critical thing as well.
Oh, okay.
Because what they're doing is it's such an important thing that he's taken it completely out of the context of Galveston itself – and said, now all we're going to do is pay attention to this and what this relationship says about this story.
Okay.
And so it's totally highlighted, clarified, simplified. If that same event wasn't going off into the wilderness, because also there is that whole metaphor of going off into the wilderness that's so important in fiction, but if it was just happening on the streets of Galveston, there would be all this clutter around it of the other events and of what's happening with Sloane and what's happening here and all this sort of thing. It really gives it more power, more simplicity, and it's a really, I think, smart way of doing it, because then he also has to find a way to bring it back into Galveston, which he does. So, yeah, no, I wouldn't take it out. I don't think it inappropriately is separate. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, no, I think it's kind of part of the rhythm of the book, really. Okay. I think...
Because I'd forgotten about all the magic. I was so intrigued.
You've forgotten about the magic.
Yes, I didn't suddenly wipe the first
180 pages. There's a Mardi Gras going on back on the island.
Because it doesn't intercut between what's going on at Galveston. He really uses genuinely its own section of the book. It felt a bit surprising. Oh, fuck yeah, that's right. There's all this magic shit going on as well. But I hear what you're saying, Jonathan. I think.
Yeah, no, I think it's there. I thought the. If there's one thing that didn't have to be there, it was the cannibalism stuff, actually. I thought that was just a bit too – not tacked on, because he made it a part of that storyline. But, I mean, it's as though that's the worst thing that people can do to each other is eat each other.
It's almost pulpy.
It really is.
It's like, we're going after pirates and we're cannibal pirates. How cool is that?
Yeah, but he gets to manipulate that poor lady about the tuberculosis.
But the guy could have done all of that. They could have still had them being captured by people who want them for, you know, for slave labor or whatever they want them for. Yeah. But, yeah, the old scary people have turned to cannibalism. I thought that was just a little too cheap.
Considering
for
there's
the
all
book.
This fish around.
Exactly. It's sort of an end of the world kind of thing that I didn't think needed to be there, especially as that's really the only exposure we get to what the rest of the world might be like.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that I buy that this island of Galveston, which has managed to sequester the magic to one side, has managed to stay civilized because of that, and the whole rest of the world's all cannibals and nothing.
Well, also,
except for that one town that does have a bit of magic, where they see the people all acting normally and smiling, and yet they find there's people being trying to dig out of the town and they're dead.
It's kind of a Stepford Wives sort of
thing.
Yeah,
it's really
happening.
Fucking freaky.
But you only ever see that right from the distance. You have no idea what's going on there, whether there's magic there or not. They're a bit freaked out, but you don't know.
Oh. You assume they've been trapped by the magic.
Well, you assume,
a bit like the carnival,
you don't know.
I would have thought. Anyway, yes, were you saying something, Jonathan? Nothing important. Okay. But look, I don't know. I did enjoy it. I love Sean's. It was longer than Mockingbird. It's double the length, and I don't know if I.
There's a lot you could cut this book down.
Yeah, I don't know if I lost a bit of momentum while reading it.
There was a lot of. Well, the phrase is your research is showing.
Yeah.
There was lot of that.
And there's a little bit of, I love this whole idea that they raised the island of Galveston 12 feet. Isn't that the most astoundingly weird thing that they jack up all the buildings and border? That's sort of astounding. I mean, it was interesting for me because I hadn't read the book in 10 years. I don't know that I really remember the detail of it that well.
Right.
I did have a powerful feeling when you asked me to pick a book that I loved, right? I remember really enjoying the book. I was thinking, Sean Stewart is someone who's largely forgotten. He's disappeared. Yes. I mean, he wrote a batch of books, gone. So this is a great chance. And I did. I considered torturing you with some old Robert Heinlein books.
Oh,
I did.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I had a whole bunch of things. Like, oh, we could do this. I could do that. No, okay. I was part of the group who gave it an award. I've loved his work. I have to say it's not my favorite of his novels now. That would be a toss between Mockingbird and Perfect Circle.
I have to read Perfect Circle.
But he's a really interesting writer. He really is.
I think he is.
And
you've got to get Mockingbird, Kirsten.
Well, maybe.
Well, particularly since they describe it. Somebody described it online because I was looking around as his girls and sisters book or something rather than his boys and adventures book.
Yeah.
And you'll it's interesting. Like it. It's interesting.
Oh, Mockingbird. Like it,
No. Because you're a girl, you'll love it. No, because you in someone who enjoys fine writing, you will – first off, Smallby Press republished it,
yep.
And they've got high quality.
And they published Perfect Circle.
Yes, they have, which is, I think, okay. Yes, I own Perfect Circle, I just don't have, I haven't read it. It is astonishing.
Well, I know, I get it, because I did, I mean, I didn't love this book, I enjoyed it. I mean, the book's 12 years old now, and a lot of the poker stuff.
Well, it hasn't
aged. You found boring.
Poker's still around, Kirsten.
No. I mean, like, there's been a lot that's been done before anyway. I mean, the house always wins line. All of the poker metaphor I found a little wearing by the end because it was just constantly there.
But then that's all about the metaphor for his luck and all that, which is
important.
It is.
But it was just kind of drummed in.
So this is where you get to judge our judgments because, of course, this tied with Declare by Tim Powers. Came in front of Perdita Street Station by China Miéville.
Yes.
That year. They were all the books that were
there. Yeah, you'd give it to Petito.
I'd give
you?
It to Petito.
Have you read that in 10 years?
No, I haven't.
See, I haven't reread any of those. I've read Loving Declare.
Doesn't matter. This one won.
I should remember one of the others because I remember that there was like four books that we were happy to give the award to.
Right. So it was a highly contested year.
It was really seriously. Right. We were going back and forth and we had the fulminating Diana Wynne Jones issue in the background as well.
The what, the who, the where?
The issue with Diana Wynne Jones because she hated Declare. She despised the book.
What's that got to do with The Price of Fish?
Well, but it was integral to how the awards turned out.
But she wasn't on the judging panel,
yeah,
was
she? Yes,
she was. Oh, was she?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
One of my happiest memories of that whole process was ringing her regularly in the UK and talking to her. And she was, you know, sort of there she would be. Her husband's listening to the cricket in the background and she's just been rummaging through a big cupboard full of gum boots and all this kind of stuff. And then we'd talk and she'd tell me what a terrible book Declare was and how we should discount it immediately. And I'm kind of going, that's not how democracy works. And then, of course, this is why I'm in it. She left. It's a public matter of public record. She left the panel. And then so when we did the final judging, there was a tie between Galveston and Declare. And things probably would have turned out differently had she stayed around and actually voted and been part of the process.
Interesting.
Did Declare joint win that with
Galveston? Yes, it did.
Mm.
Which is interesting because when I started the process, I saw we would never tie. But that's what happened.
Yeah.
But it was seriously, we sat there. I mean, at one point, I know some people sitting with – page by page with some of these books, comparing the quality of the writing and all that kind of thing.
Wow, do that?
That's hardcore awards judging.
Overall, though, I think Mockingbird's better, but this is still a very good book.
Yeah, I liked it. I did find Sloane's story. I felt the book was trying to set it up as an equal story,
yeah.
And I didn't feel it was an equal story.
No, it's not.
It was very much... Well, it's funny because you read the flat copy on this and it actually it starts with Sloan and talks about Sloan. And so I guess maybe like I read that and I thought, oh, it'll be her story. And well, actually, it's really not.
Actually, to support what Ian's saying about Mockingbird, the thing was I had partly blended the books in my memory.
Ah.
And it was only when I went back and started rereading the opening chapters of Mockingbird as part of this process that I was clarifying again, because we all read so many books.
They're not the same characters.
No, there's nothing related at all. No.
Yep.
Mockingbird's quite a different book.
Okay.
And opens with a narrative by a female character. Yep. But,
who is a fantastic character. I mean, you fall in love with her pretty quickly. Yeah.
Stop pressuring.
Oh, like this book. No, look, I'll say one thing about it. It's got weather in it. Oh. Mockingbird, like this. There's a lot of – he lot loves of his – I don't know.
He loves the weather.
Like it's got a tornado or something in that as well, doesn't
something
it?
Like, something like that.
Yeah. So
I just – I don't know. I mean I did really like it, and the things I didn't like about it are actually not fair, because I almost wanted to read another book. I wanted to read the book about the Mardi Gras and what Sloan did. That's the book I wanted to read, which is not the book Stuart wrote.
Yeah.
So it's not fair to critique the book on that grounds. But it's like I enjoyed what I read, but I kept – there was just this yearning all the way through to I want to turn the book around. I want that other book. See, I'm in there that's waving at
me. The carnival stuff actually didn't interest me. When she goes to carnival, it's just another weird bunch of people have mutated a bit.
But I think that's the thing. I wanted more than that. I wanted to know who they, because they're not a bunch of weird people. They're the other half of Galveston.
Yeah, I get that.
I want to know their story. I want to know what happened to them.
We know. They were either sent back to prison.
We have no idea what happened to them.
They were trapped there.
We have no idea what happened to them.
They live in an internal night.
We have no idea why they attracted the magic and other people didn't. If the magic, well, I mean, we know when the magic gets onto Josh. I think we called him Jake before. Josh, anyway. When the magic gets onto Josh at the end, there's a really important, poignant, serious analogy between the type of magic that affects him and how it affects him and why it affects him.
Yes.
I want to know what happened to the people who go to Mardi Gras. What was the magic that affected them and why? What does it have to do with their lives? Because they're not just carnival freaks. They're the people of Galveston. They're the other half that we don't talk about. And again, I'm not like, this is not really a criticism of the book, because how much longer could you want the book to be? But it's like I was reading the book and I was enjoying it, but I just, it was like being in a mirror maze, and we're going through the mirror maze, and I keep getting this other book waving at me.
No, you're wrong.
I wanted to chase that book.
He gives you that. The flood happens; those people come back to town.
We don't really get a lot of them. They're just refugees in their house.
I have to say, I'm a little bit
the
on cat Kirsten's
woman.
Side.
The cat woman gets shot.
What is it
she's
with you
dispensed
guys?
With?
She's got a stick.
There's not
a stick. I'll put my back
But that's it. There's not. But again, that's not a criticism of this book.
All right.
It's just that's the book I would have preferred to read out of the two. The book that hasn't been written. Sorry, Sean Stewart.
And at least you acknowledge it's one of the fundamental flaws of bad reviewing. I remember Charles Brown lecturing me, don't argue with the book.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to review the book for what it is rather than for what you want it to be.
Yeah.
And that's the book it is. And I understand. I mean, he sketches out the other part of Galveston, and it really is a thumbnail sketch, and it gives you an idea of what's going on, but he does not invest in it. And you could imagine the books or the stories or whatever else that could be written that would build that picture. Though, of course, now through this narrative that's passed, there's no point in it.
But, yes.
You know, it could have been interesting to see it, but I also agree this book is longer than I recalled it being, and it didn't need to be any longer at all.
Yes. No.
Can we point out that Jonathan saying, hey, pick short ones, chose the longest,
the
book,
longest book
that we read.
Indeed.
Hey, look, you're going to be reading Double Star by Robert Heinlein. Think about that.
How long is that?
Oh, not long at all, but it's Robert Heinlein.
It's Robert Heinlein.
Oh, okay. Well,
it's a very good Robert Heinlein.
There might have been
book,
blood on the table.
No, Jonathan, I do not. This is something I would have read at some point, because I will go through all of Sean's oeuvre.
Well, so, I think I will read Mockingbird at some point.
No, you will.
Why?
Well, A, I may reread it
you
and
may
recommend it.
Recommend it for,
recommend
the,
it
podcast.
For the podcast.
Ah, you would
or
do that.
Or B, I'll just force you, you know.
You'll force
obviously.
Me?
Yeah, whatever.
This is even worse than canon formation.
We're going to move on. So we are all recommending Galveston to various degrees.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Excellent.
I give it like four stars out of five.
That's good.
You gave it a fucking award, Jonathan.
He gave it
let's be clear here what you did. 4 out of 5 doesn't cut it. You gave it a fucking head of Lovecraft. That's what you gave that book. All right? Yeah, he agrees. Silence speaks volumes.
Don't whack the table.
Why? Does it make it?
It does.
Okay, sorry.
The next we have to start again, you know.
Yep, we'll cut it right here. Back to the beginning because Ian whacked the table.
Welcome to the writer of the... Okay, so...
Actually, just before we move on, I forgot what? I printed this out because Jonathan mentioned it before we started recording. This is a line... this is how Sean Stewart describes Galveston from his website. It's very funny. He says, this is your basic boy meets girl, boy loses everything, girl becomes her own evil twin, boy is framed for murder and sent along with sidekick to be eaten by cannibals, and things get worse when the weather turns bad story. Which I think is a beautiful summation.
It makes it sound really intriguing to read. Yes. I mean, I would want to read that story, and I did want to read that story.
And we did read that story, and we... Okay, 4 out of 5, yeah. Apparently. So,
I wouldn't speak for you. Yeah, unlike you, I'm not willing to force people to get into this.
Next book is A Carter Witch, which I recommended. I hadn't read it beforehand.
I know, but
I love it, so I would have recommended it anyway.
That's okay, because I didn't read the book I recommended.
Correct,
either.
So you're as bad as me. Sunny lives in Nigeria. But she was born in New York City. She looks West African, but she's an albino. She's a terrific athlete, but she is so sensitive to the sun that she can't play soccer during the day. She doesn't seem to fit in anywhere. Then she learns why. And basically, that's the first paragraph of the blurb because I'm not going to read the whole bloody thing. But basically, this is about the story of Sunny and her time in Nigeria and all the fun people she meets and the magic she learns. So it's sort of... If you were being really stupidly rude, you could say it's Harry Potter in Nigeria.
Oh, do you know how many Goodreads reviews I read that said that?
Oh, bullshit, really?
No,
oh,
yeah. I'm not kidding.
It's the most common comment.
Notice
it's
how I qualified by if you were being really stupid.
Harry
and rude.
Potter is the first book ever written about kids magic who school. Discover they all have right. magic
whatever
things
the Diana Wynne Jones book was that
oh
did that.
Oh, my God.
And can we agree
so
up front
insulting.
That the least interesting thing about this book is the magic school element?
Yes.
Mm. Yes, absolutely. It's just absolutely. I want to say something quite serious to begin with.
Okay.
You had a podcast with Nettie and you spoke about the book.
Oh, that was a really good podcast.
That was an excellent episode. And one of the things you discussed with her was the whole issue about writing a fantasy novel about a culture where the people in that culture believe that fantasy stuff to actually be real. Okay, yes. You touched on it, but she spoke about how difficult that can be, and you spoke about, I think, her father's funeral and the cultural stuff that she had to face when she went over to, was it Nigeria? I think it was. So that really had resonance for me because, you know, there's been a couple of times in my life when I've wanted to write stories about, not necessarily a story about a golem, but stories about my own fantastical side to my own religious mm-hmm. culture, but never been brave enough to do it because the fact of the matter is there are plenty of people, Jewish Orthodox Jews who believe it to be true, who think that that is exactly what happened. So to turn it into a fantasy novel, you're discrediting it in some way, at least in their eyes. And I can see how this book, because she's been quite true to the cultural, the mythology and the cultural stuff. I mean, I didn't do a lot of research, so I don't know what she's made up and what she's is true to the culture, but I believe most of it is pretty true to it. That's a bloody brave move because it's sort of thing that you can easily get smacked over because there are people who – I mean, it'd be like someone writing about Dreamtime, you know, especially –
Well, she is smacked over for it. I mean, she said to
has
us,
she been?
Yeah, absolutely she's been. I mean, she can't even call the book A Carter Witch in Nigeria. They have to change the title of the book.
Because, well –
But it still gets published there though.
Well, it will, but it's going to be very controversial from the sounds of things, yeah. I think it's a very courageous book and the interesting thing about it is – I don't know that 95% of Westerners who read the book will understand that it's courageous,
and that's a shame because
I don't know that it's a shame.
Because fiction, really good fiction, does have that sense of courage about it. Because if you're just writing any old shit, you know, which is easy to write. No, which is you know what it is. What we said before, Harry Potter. The fact that people think mm-hmm. it's just a version of Harry Potter in. With dark skinned people, you know, that's fucking insulting. For not just because there was books before Harry Potter, it's insulting because what she's done is she's tapped into a cultural a truth for a particular culture and written a story around it, and is willing to take the potential punishment or punitive stuff, even though she doesn't live in the country. On with that. That's amazingly courageous. Fucking J.K. Rowling didn't have to worry about that, did she? I mean, she did actually. People say, well, no, in the South they burnt her books, but I mean, come on. You know, in and only because it has witchcraft in it, but in reality, it's not the same though. It isn't the same. It isn't the same because that's a reaction to a law in the Bible, whereas this is actually playing off elements of a culture. which people take to be real.
Okay, but it's not the same. It's absolutely not the same. But it is the same flavor because yeah, it's not just playing off a line in the Bible. Like people who burnt the Harry Potter books and don't want them in their kids' school libraries and don't want their kids to read them and don't want their kid to know anything about Wicca. That's not all
Rowling sat in front of the computer and thought, shit, I better not write this because someone,
and I'm not,
well,
and I'm
or,
not
you know,
that
fuck, I'm brave
it.
Writing this.
No. I'm not saying that.
But that's, Nnedi has that. It's Nnedi or Nnedi.
Yeah.
She knew that when she started typing. She knew exactly what she was getting into. It wasn't just, I'll just make fun of, not make fun, I'll just, you know, fuck, there's good stories here. Because shit, there's so much midrashic stuff, fable stuff in Judaism that I could feed off and turn into all sorts of stuff if I felt, you know, you could, there's, I've been thinking about this, I'm getting quite passionate. You could do a series about Rabbi Akiva. He was the guy who one of the first people to learn the Kabbalah, and he was quite mystical. And you could give him powers because there was thoughts that he might have had powers. He had 2,000 students that all died on the same day, you know, from a plague because they all did because they tried to tap into things that they shouldn't have. This is all part of our culture and folklore. I could write a whole fucking story around it. One of his students who survives the plague, and it'd be a fucking awesome book. But I get into a lot of trouble.
Of who?
My faith, my people, Jews, the Jews.
All of them?
No, not all of them. But it'd be people get upset. Especially if I'm making it into a commercial thing and, you know, it gets turned into a film. No, you laugh. But,
I was laughing at the idea that it would get turned into a film.
Anything I'd write could get turned into a film. Thanks, Kirsten. No, it's
yeah, I know what you're saying, but it's – and that's – as you say, that is the situation that anyone who touches on living culture deals with.
Yes.
And even cultures we're supposed to be dead. Even, you know, there are people who get upset that people write about ancient Greek mythology as mythology.
I just want people to understand what a courageous book it is.
No, I think it is. And I'm not saying it's not – what I'm saying is I don't necessarily think it's a shame if everybody doesn't realise that. I think you can just read this book and really enjoy it and appreciate it for what it is. You don't have to sit back there and say, oh, this is such a brave book. I think the book stands on its own merits as a story. And if you get the backstory of that, as it were, that's fine as well. But I don't necessarily think it's a shame that everybody who reads this book doesn't understand the whole backstory.
And also arguably, I mean, look at the discussion we're having. It makes you think a little bit, I think. I mean, I found this book was a really interesting one. I really enjoyed it. Because it made me think about being fair to the characters and the setting that Nnedi was creating, because it's one that I wasn't intimately familiar with. Mm. I mean, you have to stop and think, if you're going to be fair to the book, what do the characters look like? What do they sound like?
Yeah.
What does a Nigerian accent sound like?
I've got no idea. Yeah.
You know, so are you, I mean, like for me, as I said to Nnedi, I mean, are you sitting there making a bad kind of Western, you know, Jamaican accent in your mind? And then you realize, of course, Sunny herself obviously has a Chicago accent because that's where she's from, as opposed to a Nigerian accent. She'll have an inflected accent at least. And then what does everybody else sound like in the story? And what are these plants that she's describing that are integral to parts of the setting of the book, which none of us have seen?
What does the landscape look like?
I found myself deliberately searching on Wikipedia for what the trees – I mean, the trees outside the entrance to the big magic school?
Yep.
I found myself wanting to go and search and find what do they look like, because they're not necessarily what I would fill in my mind.
What do they look like?
You have to go look them up on Wikipedia.
Nice.
But, you know, because I'm not that intimately familiar with the Nigerian landscape. It's been said elsewhere, one of the lazy shorthands is that we have is that Nigeria is the source of bad email scams and not much else.
Yeah.
So you turn around and say, well, okay, I've picked up this book. It's this beautiful looking book with this gorgeous cover.
It is a great cover.
And you want to engage with it fairly. And you've got this character, Sunny, who looks, what, sour milk colored? What was that? What actually
that was
is
her,
that
her
like?
Hair?
No, just skin. Her skin, because she's albino.
Yeah, but I think her hair, like...
It was. I thought it was skin the color of sour
milk.
Yeah,
I thought it was also the.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. That's how she's described by others.
And then how does she sound? And then there's the other guy who comes in from Orlu. The States. And he starts standing,
the guy from the States, yeah.
He's standing, and then there's her friends in Nigeria as well, and what they sound like and look like, and what her.
Sasha.
Well, it's like, I remember, not that it's anything like this, the same thing. They made a miniseries out of an Alexander McCall Smith book about, what is it? I forget what the thing's called. But the number one ladies detective agency.
Oh, yes. My wife loved it.
And it's not the same place, but it's not that far away from it. And you suddenly realize that there's these broad open plains, these tall trees, the environment's not what we're familiar with. And it's such an integral part of what she's doing. And, of course, because she's from there, she's painting all these pictures that she has the context for.
Yeah.
And so it's a challenge for us, I think, as readers, to actually go and embrace that context and try and understand it more, because you get more out of it. I mean, I think I said to her, I would love to hear an audiobook of this done properly, just so I could hear the characters.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's that classic thing.
So you think you missed a level?
Oh, I'm sure we all did. I'm confident we all did. I mean, and the great example we discussed was Neil Gaiman's Anansi Boys.
Yes.
Yep.
Where when Lenny Henry narrates it, you're going, oh, that's what it is. And the thing that you allow is that, or sorry, no, not that you allow, that I do, and I wouldn't presume to say anybody else does, is you put yourself in a character in a situation and you bring to it your own experience, right? So to some degree, Sonny becomes me a little bit. And if I don't spend some time learning more, then the landscape I paint is one I'm familiar with rather than the one that Nettie's creating, because whilst she's giving me the descriptions, I don't have all of the context to decrypt them.
Yeah, so you're just inserting your most close personal example into stuff, that. Yeah. So, yeah, she describes trees. You have no idea what those particular trees look like. So you throw in your idea of what a tree is, which is not going to be what the actual trees are in the book.
Or you could do things like suddenly you think, well, it's somewhere dry and hot or something. So I'll put in effectively a baobab tree or something, because I know what that looks like.
Yes.
And that could be in that kind of environment.
I just chucked in a lot of palm trees.
Well, really?
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
But I was more racist than that. I was far more racist than that when I was reading this. I thought to myself, so wait a moment, Sonny's parents are, well, they were originally Nigerian, went to America, and they decided voluntarily to go back to a place like Nigeria. Isn't that politically unstable and dangerous and bad and doesn't have internet?
So Nigeria would be okay with broadband, okay.
Yeah. Well, no, but it's fucked.
I got to say that this book I had to really think about. I mean, I initially loved the opening portions of it more than I loved some of the later portions of the book. I was really engaged before the whole magic school concept comes into play, when you're introduced to Sonny and the village and the characters, and I found it really, really engaging. And then
– and the pepper soup.
Yeah.
Oh, the pepper soup.
Which is great.
I want to make that recipe and without the magic bits. Right. Obviously.
But then I find myself sort of almost like fighting a little bit of the magic school, because it seems almost – not cliche, that's the wrong term – but something that was more familiar. It's a more familiar element brought in, and I enjoyed that that contrast. And then when the story advances to the point where you get the big battle conclusion, right? That magic big battle with
Black Hat killer guy.
Black Hat guy, right? Who's
really nasty.
Who's the theoretical villain in this book?
I mean, right? he's not just your cardboard cutout big bad guy. It's a nasty, nasty monster.
Absolutely. And beautifully drawn. But I felt when I was reading it, before I stopped to think about it and go back, that the book suffered from like coitus interruptus. That the whole Black Hat plot line resolves so quickly.
Yeah, it does.
And so neatly and so perfunctorily. And I thought, this is a failure of the book. The book's not as good as I think it is. That's really disappointing. And then I started to think some more about it and go, well, maybe if Nettie is as intelligent a writer as I think she is, she knows what she's done. So if she's done that deliberately, is it a failing of the book or is there something else going on? And that's when it became clear to me that the book is not about Black Hat at all.
Yeah. And
that conflict is irrelevant.
Yeah.
What it is about the evolution of Sonny's character and where Sonny's is at the end of that.
Yeah.
And where she may get to go in the future.
You know what's really funny? I was reading it. And that the Black Hat confrontation really is right at the end, and it's only a matter of pages. It's very short. And I'd kind of forgotten about it, and I got towards the end of the book, and they're talking about having to send them out after this killer. And I just went, oh, that's right. And I went, oh, man, there's only like three pages left. Is this going to be a book one? Will they just get to the door and book two? And I looked, it's definitely just like, I mean, there may be another one, but at this point it looks like a standalone book. All right, so I'm thinking, well, it can't be about that then. I think it was like I was smart.
You two smart people. I don't think everyone's going to take that view.
But the thing I was reading, like they were talking about going to the black hat guy, and I just went, I don't care. Yeah. I'm really into this story about the soccer and the magic and her.
But that's because it's about that.
The missteps about that she has.
Yes, I get that. Yeah. But I think the problem is because you're right. You're 100% right. And I know, and Eddie confirmed that on the podcast that you had with her and said, you know, she hates that you have to end with a big battle and the battle's going to be 80 pages long. And why the fuck do you need to always do that? Agree with you 100%. The thing is, though, she's still using that structure, though. There's still a battle at the end, whether it's a page long or 50 pages long. In a sense, for me, it would have been a lot more interesting and a lot more subversive if they fucked off Black Hat in the middle of the book or two-thirds of the way through.
Well, actually, what occurred to me
unless
is...
Because I think even if she's been really, really clever, most of your audience ain't going to figure that out. They're not going to be as smart as you guys.
Well, maybe. But I mean, I would like to think that the audience is smart.
Well, they're not because they think it's Harry Potter in Nigeria. But seriously, that's what they think.
I think the way the book's working, and if you have a look at all the things that happen to Sunny and what she does from the moment she finds out she's one of the leopard people, which is who the magic users are called. And all of the things and all the mistakes she makes. And she makes so many mistakes. And it's good because her mistakes have consequences.
Yeah.
You know, people – she isn't the – you know what? She isn't Harry Potter who makes mistakes and people go, oh, there, Harry. We'll clean up after you. It's okay. And all these things that happen. And the black hat thing is like it's just one of those things. And all the things that happened to her along the way.
But it ultimately falls into the trap of having the black hat as the focus at the end, which seems to say, clever reader.
The focus at the end is Sunny getting together with her mentor. And the black hat was the way she got together with her mentor.
I get that. So that's her story.
Like her story.
You realize I agree with you guys.
Yeah, but this is it.
But I'm saying that the structure of it, it sets up the argument with, and the person has every right to make that argument that, oh, but it was perfunctory.
Well, that's only
if, I mean, the fact of the matter is, it was your first reaction. You had to think about it. Not everyone's going to think about it like you are, Jonathan. You know. They're going to go, oh, really? Black hat?
Well, then you know what? Then it's not a book for them.
Yeah. It did make me wonder if the black hat resolution should have happened off camera.
That would have been an interesting way of doing it, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Black Hat himself was sidelined by the fact that he's not actually the big bad.
Yeah.
And that big bad hasn't been defeated. That big bad has been momentarily pushed to the side of the stage.
And even the big bad wasn't that interesting. It was really this other stuff.
But the whole the story isn't group of kids get together, fight monster. The story is girl out of her element in more ways than one, finds out a whole bunch of important stuff about herself.
And her family.
Makes this arc from being kind of no one to being...
Well, more being an outcast because she's an albino.
Yeah, I mean, she's kind of no one, right? She's not incredibly great at school. She's not incredibly... I mean, she's...
No, but she's not just a no one.
She's outside.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and she's still outside at the end of the book because she's inside another place that she didn't know existed before. But she's still very much like in the waking world, in the non-magic world, she's still exactly where she was.
Yes.
Except she's got a bit of a better relationship with her mother.
Yeah.
But really, in the waking world, she was.
The father-daughter relationship was really, really good. The fact that this is a man who can get angry, not necessarily abusive, but has very, very narrow view of the world and the tension for Sunny and that. I just wanted to chuck that in because that was some really good background.
So her whole story arc of Sunny in this book is actually from being not even a novice but not being magic at all to getting to a point where she has earned the right to have a mentor and to embrace who she is and what she can do and to be taught that. And that's her whole arc. And the fact that, all three of us come to this from what has become a very well-established fantasy trope of forming a posse to go out and hunt the bad guy, that we don't even see what the actual arc of this story is. I think that's really telling. And you might be right. There might be a whole bunch of people who come to it with that trope, don't see past it and think it fails because it doesn't fit that trope.
I'd be curious. When
it's not trying to fit that
trope. Do we know
trope.
Who editor was on this?
Sharon November.
Oh, Sharon November. I'd be curious to know whether Sharon was smart enough to figure it out straight
I'm sure
off.
I'm sure she was.
Or whether she said, hey, that ending what happened there?
Sharon's a very cluey editor. I'm sure she got the book right away.
Yeah,
and it's only, you know, fools like me who have to sit there and have a think about it and sit there. Because I did. I felt almost let down a little bit at first.
But you were reading much in the same way, I guess, that I was reading Galveston wanting it to be another book.
Yeah. Well, the thing was
You're coming to this book with a different pattern.
I guess
book pattern in your head.
I had to fight the pattern because it was an unsatisfying example of the pattern.
Yeah.
And I wasn't interested in the pattern, but there were enough signposts to have me expect or anticipate the pattern.
Yeah, that's it. That's right, yeah.
And it's a matter of, trying to be open enough to the book you're reading to say, well, is this book a failure or is it a success and I missed the point? And can I work out the point and does that retrospectively make it seem more satisfying? And it immediately did as soon as I had.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah,
well, I think it's a great book.
Yeah, no, I really, really like it. It's funny.
I loved it. I mean, I adored it. I love the little inserts, which I think they go away after a while from the
little from the book.
Yeah,
from the book of magic,
the walkie book, the book that has legs under it, doesn't it?
Part of me, because I did a little bit of research and I think maybe even. It might have even been on your podcast, Jonathan, where Nettie was saying she might be writing another sequel to it. And part of me thinks, yeah, that's great, but I'd also really be happy just to leave Sunny and her story here and just see what else Nnedi Okorafor writes. Because I think she's a really amazing writer. Jeez. And because this is the second book we've done on this podcast. We also did Who Fears Death last year. And they're quite different books. And
but yet similar in some ways because there's also the learning about magic.
Well, they're similar because Nnedi Okorafor has written them.
Well, yeah.
Oh, my God.
No, I'm not saying that in a facetious way. I mean,
well,
like
which
her
way
voice...
are you saying it, Kirsten?
Yeah, because her voice has...
No, but they're also about a girl that learns about her magic and...
Oh, yeah.
Da-di-da. And also, Who Fears Death also has, in a sense, a perfunctory ending. If you go by the pattern because she comes across her... We probably shouldn't spoil that.
Well,
here, should we?
No, because we're not spoiling
spoil
another book.
Yeah.
If you want that book spoiled, go back and listen to the episode where we talk.
I think
about
it has an abruptish ending, but again, not necessarily the point of the book.
But this is the thing, and this is why I think Nnedi Okorafor is such an interesting writer because she's working in this fantasy, and let's call it a landscape rather than a genre or anything like that. She's working in here, but she's not following the paths that have been sort of dug into this landscape over the decades. So, you know, you come to her books and you might think you're getting this particular book which will go along this path and there are signposts and all of the sort of stuff that we've been saying, but it's not. And she's off over somewhere else doing something really interesting in a bit of land that no one's actually done much with to date. And that's why I find her such an interesting writer because I really love reading the books. And with Who Fears Death, I think I was much more – I think maybe with Akata, which I expected it to be a bit different because I'd read Who Fears Death and that – did have that effect with me of going, oh, this isn't quite behaving the way it should. But that's not what she's doing. And I think I want to read more books like this.
It's the best soccer game I've ever read.
Oh, it's fantastic.
I'd also say that if she does write a sequel, which she said she probably may at some point.
She probably may.
It's not going to be Sunny Potter and the Chamber of Secrets.
Oh, good.
Nor is it going to be, I would imagine, a Carter Witch 2.
Yeah. Did she say she'd probably said it? Oh, am I imagining it? She said it some years later.
She said she was thinking. She had thought she had.
I think she has an intention to write more about this world and with these characters, but
not necessarily.
She's not revealed what she may do at this point.
So it might happen the next day, but it might happen 10 years in the future.
And she's got other stuff to do. She's got to do a Tinkerbell book and the other stuff. So,
Yeah, that's right, the Tinkerbell book.
That's awesome.
I mean, she could theoretically do a sequel to Who Fears Death as well.
Really? Yeah,
absolutely.
I guess. Kind of.
The world doesn't end at the end.
No, the world doesn't end.
But books don't need
sequels. We don't
want to
spoil a book that we're not discussing.
No, exactly.
My thing coming, as I said, is the courage of the book. And it's just so beautifully written. It's so easy to read. And books that you read quickly sometimes is because the prose is very transparent, so it's easy just to churn through it. Not like this. You read it quickly because you want to know what happens next, obviously. just sentence to sentence, she's beautiful. The story she wrote for you in Life on Mars. Yes, that's also awesome. That's also beautifully written.
I have to read that.
She is a terrific, terrific writer.
Yeah,
I mean, she is top notch.
It always sounds a bit patronizing. Oh, she's a real talent.
I know.
But really, just fantastic.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And if you have, well, thanks. But if you haven't dipped into Nettie's work, and you should definitely do not buy an e-book of the book.
The hardcover is a beautiful, beautiful thing. Yes.
We're sitting here around the table. I'm looking at your copies. Mine's safely at home. I would feel disappointed not to own that book.
Yes.
In an era where it doesn't really matter. I mean, and hats off to the people at Viking who designed this. This is just a lovely book.
Even the font is beautiful.
Yeah.
I read the bloody thing. I know the font's great. But I wasn't going to mention it on the podcast. I thought, you know, there's a line in the sand.
Yes, could you hold it up to the camera and let everybody see? Yeah,
exactly. The video podcast. Remember that?
Maybe you need to take a scan of the page and put it up with show notes so everybody can see it.
You know what? She'll do that. If you say that, she'll. Yeah. Where's the stick on him?
He's the guest. You can't point your stick to guest.
Oh, my God. Put it down.
For all the other font nerds out there. It's been typeset in Kennelly.
Absolutely. We haven't really spoiled it that much. No. I mean, we did talk about the end, but it's not the point of the novel.
I think there's – because the end of the book isn't the point of the book, and there's so much beautiful, funny, magical, wonderful things that happen all the way through.
And the best soccer match you'll ever
read. It's a pleasure to read.
So I think we agree that we give it enough stars to – however many stars it takes for you to go out and buy a copy of it and
actually,
read it.
Your thoughts about whether this will appear on the World Fantasy ballot?
I would be surprised if it wasn't there. Put it that way.
Okay.
I think it was an interesting year for books, and you have to really sit about all the books that came out in 2011. And I think that Delia Sherman's book, The Freedom Maze, has a lot of weight behind it. But I would be surprised. Yeah, I think it would be a very worthy nominee. She won last year, of course.
Yes. Oh, good point. Yeah.
So certainly world fantasy people are aware of her. So yeah, I would expect it to.
And just on a side, after the very first book we reviewed, Deathless, that's a stand-up start for the world fantasy. Nothing's ever a stand-up start, but... You'd think so, wouldn't you?
Nah, it's got no chance.
No chance? You heard that first from Jonathan Strahan, everyone. Especially you, Kat Valenti.
We're gonna move right along.
What
do
they mean? Okay, so this is your book.
My book.
Christ, which, do you recommend books sometimes?
Goodness, yeah.
Which I also had not read before I recommended it, but it is Caitlin Kiernan, so I didn't care.
Our second Caitlin Kiernan.
You didn't
as well.
Squee, did you?
It's funny when you were talking about at the beginning, Jonathan, where you might read two or three things by an author, not like them. That's it. You're not interested anymore. Because I don't think if I hadn't recommended The Red Tree to Ian last year, I don't think you ever would have picked that book up because you haven't liked her other novels that you've read, have you?
No, let's be clear here.
Oh, okay, sorry.
First off, I got it slightly mucked up with Kathy Koja.
Oh.
All right. First off. And second off, when I was young and stupid, I early met you when she'd written the first one.
Silk.
I really didn't get into Silk, but I think if I reread Silk now, knowing what – and I know it's early in her career and she, you know, and I think she's revising
it. To be honest
– can I finish a sentence?
Okay.
I'm trying to justify my own stupidity.
No, and I'm trying to cut you off at the pass and saying you're actually not stupid.
Okay.
Because I don't think I would recommend any of her other novels to talk about on the podcast.
Before The Red Tree.
Before The Red Tree.
And I'm sure she would say the same thing.
I think
she said that she's on not entirely pleased with the first couple, I think.
I think all of them to a certain extent. I find interesting and fascinating things about all of them. I don't think any of them up until The Red Tree, I would have said she is a much, 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 much better short story writer than she is a novelist. And her novels tend to get a bit lost. And then she wrote The Red Tree, which is astounding.
You've got another.
So now I think she's
refer them to the podcast.
An equally good novelist. I think she's, yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, apart from Silk, a lot of those books have those disgustingly silly, paranormally like romance covers on them.
Depends on who published them, but the latest reissuing, yeah, they were not very good.
Because the Red Tree cover's dreadful.
It is. And the Drowning Girl cover's good.
Brilliant.
It is a beautiful book.
Yeah.
Again.
The Drowning Girl cover is great.
It's really good.
You're a fight against the e-book storm.
A little bit. Although this one I
wouldn't
disagree. As a book. No. It's an artifact. Book, it's a paperback. It's an okay book. It's
just, and interestingly,
but it has a beautiful cover.
In terms of how Caitlin tends to talk about herself online, I think a little bit, this does not look like it necessarily is a genre book. It could be a mainstream book.
It definitely could
absolutely.
Be.
Absolutely.
You know?
I considering how shit the cover of Red Tree is, masking a magnificent book in between that cover, I'm so glad that someone – I don't know if it's a different publisher. Maybe it is.
No, same publisher.
Well, fuck, whoever it is in Rock, thank God that they woke up and said, yeah, shit, she actually deserves proper covers and not just some bit of paranormal romance reject sort of thing. With a woman who looks nothing like the mate. No, I'm sorry. I don't think Caitlin will disagree with me.
The red tree was bad. The red tree is very,
gorgeous.
Very bad.
And of course, the trailer that goes with it, which I actually watched about 30 times while I was reading the book.
Okay.
Because it gave it's got me
a really good trailer.
The last thing you need is some chick in leather pants standing hip shot looking back over her shoulder in this book. I mean, really, could you imagine it? Having read Caitlin Keenan's blog, I'd expect you to actually walk physically from Rhode Island to New York and club someone to death if they did it, right, with a bigger stick than you have.
Just go, fuckers, get the fucking point, read the fucking thing.
I do have to say that I love that there's a little leaf, which I think is kind of a nod back to the Red Tree.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's why they put the leaf in.
Just cover design. Yeah. I think it is.
What's the font in this one, Kirsten?
Shut the font up. In this one. You're mocking me, but I don't care because I'm a font nerd. Yeah, right. I really like them. It's Sabon.
Oh, yes. Standard font.
Actually, there are two fonts, so.
Oh, just put it down. I was joking the first time. No, really, seriously.
Okay.
Thanks. So, whose book do you? You've got to introduce it.
So, this is the book I chose. This is. Caitlin Keenan. I was going to say her second novel. Isn't that weird?
I'm having it.
It's her latest novel. It just came out at the beginning of, in April, I think, this year. I don't know that we could spoil this book. I'm not sure we could because I don't know that I can really say exactly what this book is about.
This book is resistant fantastic. To spoilage.
Absolutely.
So we're just going to talk about it. But it's basically, it is written, it is the manuscript written by India Morgan Phelps, who's known as Imp. That's her initials. And she's telling us a ghost story, which is the first line of the book, actually. And it's a book about it's about being haunted. It's about art. It's about writing. It's what art and writing does to the writer and the reader. It's about holding discordant things in your head at the same time and liking that feeling. I think that's the best way I can describe this book because that's what this book does.
Or not.
Because it does slightly impair her a bit.
As a reader of this book, that is what this book does to me.
Okay.
And I really like it. I really like that by the end of this book, not only do I not know exactly what has happened in quote unquote reality as opposed to what has gone on in Imp's perception, but I don't want to. Like, I find it really, really enjoyable just to have all these loose pieces rattling around in my head and making connections and not making connections and contradicting each other and supporting each other and doing all these things. And I like that. I don't want an answer. I don't want someone to come up and go, actually, here's who Eva Canning was. Here's what happened. Here's what was made up by Imp. I don't want that. That would ruin the book.
Please.
Yes.
You just did – it's Pseudopod, the horror podcast, just did one of your stories, she said, which is also about an artist. No, there's it connects. And I was reading the post – it went up and I was reading the forum, the Pseudopod. iPod forum to see some reviews of the
podcast. There's reviews now.
Yeah, the very first one is someone writing. It's not entirely positive. Is someone writing, and it isn't, saying, why do all artists have to be twisted and dark? You know, not every bloody artist is twisted and dark. Why has that got to be? Why do people always write about that? So that person probably won't like The Drowning Girl either. That's the point I'm trying to make.
So you're saying that there is at least one person in the world that provides a link between my work and Caitlin Keener's work by liking neither?
Yes. Yes.
All right.
Yes. But she said it's awesome. So we have that clear. She said it's a wonderful piece of writing. Different story altogether. But you're, yeah. But I just want to, I just want to say how stupid that sort of sentiment is, because
the sentiment that all artists are twisted and
Why do people feel that they have to write fiction about twisted artists?
I'm not clear. The sentiment that people are writing fiction about, that's stupid, or the questioning of why they're doing it is stupid?
Well, the thing that the person wrote on the interwebs I thought was silly.
Okay.
Questioning why people like Kirsten McDermott and Caitlin R. Keenan, first I feel the need to make artists twisted and dark, and B, why they have to feel the need to write about these people.
But the world is full of plenty of stories about happy, creative people.
Apparently not, according to this person.
There are.
Okay.
I mean, really.
Well, there are.
And, you know, setting aside for a second this person's questioning of Kirsten's work.
Yes, can we please set that aside?
Bringing a sort of half circle back to the
feeling
book
very uncomfortable
about.
Now.
It's kind of irrelevant to this book, which is this fascinating, dark, immersive book. And immersive is really, is I think, the term I came up in my mind for how I felt about it.
Yeah,
yeah, it's a very good word.
You sink into Imp's mindset and her questioning of the difference between truth and reality and honesty and what happened as she tries to, I mean, it's called The Drowning Girl, a memoir, and this is someone who doesn't trust her own memories.
Yeah.
And it's all about
who can't trust her own memories.
And the first thing she says to you is, you know, sort of basically, I don't know the difference between what happened and what didn't. I don't trust what I'm saying. I'm trying to be honest with you, but I don't know if it's true.
Actually, the line she keeps repeating throughout, not verbatim, but the theme that she keeps repeating throughout the book, even when she's talking about stuff that she knows at some point isn't, like, could not have happened, is that truth and fact are not necessarily the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's probably, like, well, I mean, it's definitely one of the major themes of the book, and it's probably the one through line that you have to kind of remember, that even though Imp, what Imp's writing about and what she's remembering or what she's confabulating may not always bear resemblance to fact, as in what actually happened objectively that other people could see in the real world, doesn't mean her story isn't true.
Yes.
And that's awesome. I mean, to write a whole book around that idea and to pull it off.
Yes. And to say that this is an unreliable narrator doesn't even begin to come close to it, because she's so overt about her unreliable narration.
Yes. Yes. She's not the to go back to a book which you know what, I can't even remember now. We did Liar, yeah? Yeah, we did Liar.
Yeah, we did Liar. Don't spoil Liar.
No, I won't spoil Liar, but in a book like Liar, you've got a narrator who tells you something, gets you to believe it, and then says, actually, sorry, I lied. The unreliability of the narrator in Liar is overt and conscious, and that is not what Imp is doing. Imp is very honestly and painfully trying to reconstruct for herself, because she said throughout the – at the beginning, she says she's not going to show it to anyone. About halfway through, she says, I might show it to my psychiatrist or my girlfriend. But basically, she's not writing it for an audience.
Yeah.
She's writing it for herself to try and understand
very much
what happened at this time in her life.
Yes.
And you – I mean, you do lie to yourself, and she does, but you're not doing it consciously when you do something like that.
And there is a whole mechanism of how, as she attempts to understand what's happening to her, we are shown her interacting with another point of view and how that breaks her ability to understand what's happening to her and how she has to reform her worldview of what's happened.
Yeah, there's that, like you're talking about where she meets Abilene in the car park.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's amazing that bit because she meets her Abilene, who was her girlfriend, then they split up. So at the point she meets her again, it's been a year, something like that. And like all up until this point, she's got in her head these two contradictory, mutually exclusive stories
of how she met a particular person
about Eva Canning, about what happened, and she seems to sit there writing this manuscript, going about her day quite happily, acknowledging the presence of these two stories. But it's not until Abilene,
says, "Hang on,
calls
a second,
her on it
that never happened."
That's when she can't. Like, she can live with it herself.
Yeah.
She can't live with it when other people.
Yeah. Because she's accepted, I guess, her own contradictory perceptions on a day-to-day basis. You know, I live in a world of unreliable perception, so I will encompass in my worldview contradictory things and be unconcerned by them.
Yes. You know?
And so, as you say, there's this sort of – there's the first time I met Eva Canning and there's this story, and then there's the second time that I meet Eva Canning and then there's that story. And you're going, well, hang on, is it the July story or is it the November story?
Yeah.
Because is it winter? Is it summer?
Because
is
you
it?
Can't meet Eva Canning for the first time twice.
Twice, no.
And yet each time is for the first time.
And this is not a time travel story.
Not at all, not remotely.
No.
And so it's really interesting and powerful, and it – goes to what an important character Abilene is in the book, in terms of being a touchstone for Imp with reality, because she's this external check. And this, I think it's also really interesting that she's this character that falls in love with Imp, and you're not given an easy shorthand as to why. I mean, I find myself really liking Abilene
a lot.
Like, I think she's a great character, right? And I think Imp's a great character. And in the first third of the book, and I did an odd thing for various reasons. I read the two halves of this book 2 months apart.
Oh, okay.
You know, and I even, because I started reading it immediately after A Carter Witch, I did something that I was doing with A Carter Witch. So I actually looked up on Google Maps Rhode Island.
Oh, okay.
I looked at exactly where Imp's house was. And it's there.
Yeah,
and the street's there, and the park at the end of the street's there.
You're kidding.
So the actual geography is exactly right for Rhode Island.
Yeah.
Right? She hasn't fictionalized any of it. So it's actually, if you like, for a metaphor with the book, the geography of the book, which is so important to its story, is fundamentally factual and strong.
It's a bedrock, yeah.
And it's got this story on top of it, which at least appears to be absolutely unreliable and contradictory.
That's brilliant.
And shifting through shadow and all this sort of stuff.
And peopled with...
Yeah.
That's a brilliant layer I never considered, that the bedrock is all there firm, but there's something on top of that just is amorphous.
Yeah.
It's guess. I don't know. It's brilliant.
And I mean, and it's interesting reading a book where the whole point of it is not some – I mean, you're saying about it remains questioning.
Yeah.
You could sit here and there's chunks – and there's a couple of little bits of the book that I didn't enjoy, though I don't think they're bad. Yeah. But I never – I didn't come away going, this is a book about this. This is what happened. This is what I will tell people about it. And this is the important thing, for this book, it's a success that it's like that, not a failure.
Absolutely.
You know.
And the Red Tree did that to some extent as well.
In a way more conventionally, though.
In a way more conventionally. But it also...
it's a lost document sort of deal.
It did just refuse to resolve the actual story, which it could have done very easily as a lost document.
Yeah.
It could have very easily had a framing device saying, oh, and here's what happened. And would have ruined the book if it had done that.
Of course, absolutely.
But, yeah, she does that even more with The Drowning Girl. The Drowning Girl... The Red Tree was kind of a deliberate cipher in that she – I think there's kind of enough clues in The Red Tree to piece together a limited number of alternate narratives about what actually happened
in
the house.
Just blame it on Cthulhu.
Right? Sorry? Just blame it on Cthulhu. Well, I don't know that you can find a textual support for that reading. No. But anyway, but in The Drowning Girl – I don't think you can. I think it's impossible to find. About the only one you can discount.
Well, no. But see, the end notes, the sort of end notes at the very end, seem to be some weird attempt to do that and yet not succeed. And I find them odd.
I think the end notes are there to kind of reinforce the arbitrary nature of this story.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
That it's not
interesting.
Like it has an arbitrary beginning and arbitrary end, and it's almost like Imp can't let the story go.
Yeah.
Because the end paper, I mean, they take place over a couple of years, and they're just tiny little snippets of, and you just picture Imp coming back to this. To this physical manuscript that she's typed on a typewriter and stuck other bits of paper into and everything. And I did anyway, and I'm reading the end bits. It's like I just pictured her coming back every few months and, like, for coming across a something or something happens, she goes, oh, that's kind of part of my story too, and going back and adding something to it. And, like, it just doesn't end. And it still hasn't ended, I don't think.
I'm not saying that they're wrong the end.
I'd also say those notes are a journey to the last paragraph of the book.
Yes.
Because the last paragraph of the book is the grace note to the whole story. It's the I don't want to say reward or the victory for Imp or anything like that, but it's the gift of the story to her. That she has found someone who loves her she knows it and all that. And it's how
we're all looking at the last paragraph to remind us.
Well, it's because I was thinking about it because I was reading that this morning.
Very weepy when I read that.
And that's
last
it. And you've got to get what she has to do as a writer with a story is find a journey from the end of the Evie Canning story, which is superficially the end of the book.
Yeah.
Yes.
To the point where you see this thing, which is this core part of the story, which is the resolution, if you like, or the implication of a resolution of the story of Abilene and Imp. Because, I mean, several times during the book, she tells you, Abilene left me.
Yes.
We're not together anymore. And you could readily, because readers are as unreliable as writers and narrators, you can easily lose track of the fact that of where you are in time for the story and is she with Abilene or is she not? Abilene came, Abilene went. Abilene had great reasons for leaving, but she still came back. Abilene saves her life. Abilene rescues her. And then you get to this last statement, which I personally would leave unspoiled for people to read themselves, but it's beautiful and it's very appropriately to the book, very honest.
Yeah.
And if it's sentimental, it's in a very pure and reasoned, pure and good kind of sentiment.
It's not
cheap sentimentality. It's emotion.
It's well earned. It's a well earned.
It is. I mean, this is a character. I mean, in fact, both of them, in fact. But this character has gone through such an excoriating experience that to have some grace note in her life that will give her hope for her future and everything else is what you need in the book as well. I mean, your emotional reaction speaks a lot to that very fact.
Yeah.
You need that thing. What you want. I mean, you don't want. Tidy it up, dot the I's, cross the T's, they all lived happily after. But you want to know there's something for Imp. I mean, she's gone through this, and you've got no idea whether for the rest of her life she's going to – I mean, there's a moment where, right, there's a moment where she's taking Eva Canning to the ocean. This is the second Eva Canning. And Eva's sort of saying, I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to do – and she doesn't say what she's going to do, but she's going to do something for her. And the little part of it goes, she's going to make her not crazy, right? And then she's not crazy and she can live happily ever after.
Oh, I never thought
which is
about
utterly
that.
Bullshit and isn't what would happen. It isn't what Caitlin Keenan would write in a second, I'm sure. But the thing that's opened up is the ability for Imp to have this love and this relationship into a future.
Yeah.
And that's the thing she has.
Yep.
And I think it it's as much a reward. It's as much a reward for the reader because in the same way as we were saying about a Carter Witch being, that book is Sunny's story arc. It's not so much about any one thing that happens along the way. It's what happens with Sunny and how she ends up rather than any event. And, I mean, we don't get a resolution to the ghost story that Imp's telling us, but we get a resolution to Imp's story at, as you say, at a point where the resolution is nice.
Can I jump?
Might
can
not also, be nice well in we, 10 as, years, but it's nice now.
Can I jump in? Because one of the things I'm concerned about, again, I'm always concerned about how people will react to a book.
Hmm.
I know, it's, I don't know what's wrong with me. is that people get caught up in a sense that we have as well as to the what's real, what's not, what's this really all about, sort of Philip K. Dickian sort of, you know, what's reality, what's not reality sort of conversation where one of the main things about this book that I absolutely, again, thought was courageous, is that this is a book about mental illness, about what mental illness does to you, what does to people that you love. Whether there is a mystical element to this or not is completely fucking irrelevant. It's about the earwig thing, for example, you know, that meme just going on and on in their head. That fucking happens to people around us, fucking driving them insane. and that she wrote this book, which is a very, I would dare say, is very personal and very, you know, very raw, and pulls it off, because you can easily get really shitty with him because she's very self-aware at times, and ooh, you know, there's that sort of postmodern-y sort of self-awareness. But you realise, well, there is, at least in the first third, you know, no one's ever going to read this, and that sort of,
well, that's not true, Imp. That's not Imp. That's.
But there's the editor talking to her. She's her talking to herself a lot. You know, come on, Imp, get back to the point. That sort of thing you could get easily annoyed with, thinking, you know, it's that sort of what they call it, signal from Fred, signal from the author. The author's playing games. But you realise, no, that's not what this is. It's about a woman struggling with her mental issues.
Yep.
And mental illness is something that's not written about a lot, or if it is, it's made into very melodramatic telemovies and things like that. It's never written in this sort of very raw but also extremely sensitive sort of way. And that's what's brilliant about this book, because you could easily just fucking throw it across the room and go, Imp, you're just too much for me. But you, as you said, Jonathan, I think you could. God, that's going to be a strange look. You said it's immersive, and that's the brilliance of it. Mm. She's making us be with Imp the whole way, mental illness or not. That harrowing bit where there's this sort of weird sex thing going on with Eva Canning. And
Chapter 7.
Yes, Chapter 7. Yep. You know, whether she is she a it's incubus
the
or
werewolf
what the,
and
werewolf. Yep. What the fuck? Who knows what the fuck's going on? Really hard to read that. Really, really hard to read, but brilliantly written that you can't help but read it. And that's just it's everything. I'm sorry, but what are you apologizing for? I just don't want people to think, oh, it's all about reality and is what's real, what's not. It's got that mental illness thing to it as well, which can't be forgotten, because that's to me, that's more the core of the novel.
Schizophrenic.
Yeah, I get
like
that.
But I'm saying, like, that's out in the open. It's not. There's no. There's. Yeah,
because I've drugs.
No, but the thing is,
she
we have. About, I, yeah,
you know,
but the
you
thing
know
is,
the poignant bits for me were when she says, "Oh fuck, I forgot to take my drugs."
Yeah.
You know those sort of moments. I know it's just a little thing, but it just brings it back.
Yeah, but I think what this, because I don't think we ever made clear up to this point that Imp actually, I mean, she is schizophrenic. She is on medication. She has recognized illness.
And her grandmother and her mother also has
this is
mental
not,
illness.
This is not a book that is trying to play with us about, oh, is she or is she not crazy? This is the book
She's
is not doing that at all.
Right out of the box.
But there's this great bit where it's right near the beginning too, and Imp is saying something about how people always say crazy people don't know they're crazy, and she's saying that's bullshit. We're just as capable of self-reflection
and
articulation as anyone else. Which was a beautiful little moment, because and it's right near the beginning, and the book is like laying it squarely in front of you that this is not asking you to question whether or not Imp is schizophrenic. Yeah. She is.
Yeah.
Now this is her story.
Yes.
And it's I mean that is not done. I mean it's a rather It's done way too often and too badly where that's the point of the story. Oh, is the character crazy or not? And it's very much the opposite of the point of The Drowning Girl.
Yeah.
Which is what you were saying.
Yeah. You always say it a bit nicer, though.
But no, because when you were saying that, I thought, oh, maybe it sounds like we were saying the book is about whether or not she's crazy, and that's beside the point. The book is about perception.
No, but I'm saying even people who come into the book knowing she's crazy and get all the schizophrenic stuff, that not to be left just with the thing of, yes, she's schizophrenic, but all that question, well, who was Eva Canning? And, you know, which one was true?
Yeah,
and,
no, it's,
and not
it's,
to be left with the, oh, I really don't know. That discussion is useful, and we've had it and it's great, but you just don't want to forget that mental illness and the whole.
No, and Imp is really frank about that. I mean, she's really frank about her medical history, her family history.
I loved all that.
Her interviews.
Yeah. I mean, loved it in a I'm glad the mum committed suicide way, but in a you just don't get.
But no, she's really frank and open about it.
Oh, by the way, you know another discussion I don't want to hear? Is this a genre book or not? Should it be on ballots or not? Because if anyone starts fucking bringing that up, they deserve to be taken out and shot. I really do think, because, again, you're just fucking pissing on a beautiful piece of work if you start fucking having that conversation.
At the very least,
I just want to heap it. It's you, John.
Okay.
No.
The conversation will be had.
What I'd say about it is, apart from the fact that it's irrelevant,
yes,
at the least it's a ghost story. If you want to talk about is it genre, it's a ghost story.
And
you can quibble about what kind of ghost story it is.
Yeah.
But it's a ghost story.
Well, she defines what a ghost story is in this. And within the definition as per the book, it meets that purpose.
And I certainly can't imagine a more haunted character
than
an
imp. Yeah, no, yeah. It's just, I think, maybe it was Peter Straub or someone has, yeah, I can see on the cover actually, Peter Straub described it as a masterpiece, and that's exactly what it is. Yeah. And like in the genuine sense of the word, in that you can, I mean, I've read Kiernan since she started publishing, and you can see, like, through her other novels and her short fiction, you can see the development of this writer, and yeah, this.
So I came to her later than you did.
It is a masterpiece.
And I'd read an increasing amount of her short fiction and an awful lot of her online discussion about herself and her life and all that kind of stuff. Yep.
In her blog and.
Yeah, all that kind of thing. Yep. And it makes this a fascinating book.
Yeah.
Because. I mean, I think it's crass and coarse and inappropriate to get into the autobiographical or non-autobiographical elements of this.
Yeah.
But it certainly colours it and shows you what an intensely personal book it is, which I think is with that question. I mean, it's a raw book.
Yeah. I don't think it is crass. I think it may be uncomfortable because she's still very much a living and working writer.
Sure.
But when you look at the history of literary criticism, so much of it is about teasing out biography from text and looking at the interplay between an author's life and life experiences and philosophies and what they wrote, and that is a huge and significant component of literary criticism. And it feels uncomfortable to talk about it with a living writer.
Yeah,
but she's very honest and alive journalist.
And, I mean. Yeah, but and that's maybe where Jonathan says it feels a bit crass.
Also, I don't want to.
But I think that's.
Well, coarse then, or something.
Yeah.
It's because I wouldn't want, as someone talking about this book to an audience, to reduce it to a game of bingo where you try and say, well, that bit's from Caitlin Keenan's life, that bit sounds like her talking on her journal, that kind of thing. Because however accurate that is or is not, it's besides the point. The reading of the book.
It absolutely is.
And I read Caitlin,
but as Curse is saying, the literary critics are going to do that. Whether it's today or 30 years from now, they'll do it anyway.
Yeah, but just fuck them. I mean, it's true. There are times when Imp is testy about something, or she's talking about fighting with her writing or something, and she sounds just like Caitlin on her blog.
Yes.
This piece of work, and I didn't get to go out because it was rainy, and I fucking hate the weather. And
but I think my
girlfriend, who could be either her Imp or her Abilene. Yeah, you know, I mean, who she talks about, who's reading her work and helping her with all sorts of stuff.
That's spooky.
Spooky. You know, it seems like there's a parallel there. And you're going, the problem, and in a sense, I would love to have read this book without any of that in my head.
Yeah, I think.
It doesn't damage the reading at all.
It doesn't damage the reading at all.
Yeah, I understand.
I don't know.
I mean, I fight when I hear writers in books talking about writing. And there's times when Imp talking about writing and struggling with the writing of her memoir sounds like Caitlin struggling with writing her work.
Yeah. And this book was really difficult for her to write.
Without a doubt.
I'll rephrase that. When she finally found a way to write the book, the writing was quick and I think comparatively easy, and I think she would say that herself. But trying to find a way into starting this book was really difficult for her.
Yeah. I would absolutely imagine that's true. And so that's there are these superficial autobiographical elements that are similar. There are some similarities between Abilene and Caitlin herself. And I'm sure there are other parallels that people could tease out. And I'm not sure how I feel about it. I'm not sure how I feel about how right it is to talk about that. Not because you shouldn't talk about things, but just whether it's relevant to a reading of this book, which we're experiencing, and which I think we would overwhelmingly recommend to anybody else to experience.
Absolutely.
Though I would certainly never say you're going to have an easy experience with this book. I mean, the opening bits of it where she's telling you she's unreliable, I mean, I found it immersive. I found it seductive, bewitching. You know, that whole idea. I mean, I liked Imp right out of the box because she was honest with me.
Yeah.
She had this framed sort of life where she had her job, people were looking after her, she was all by herself, she had her mother's records, this whole kind of thing. Yep. Then she meets spontaneously, just as spontaneously as she meets Eva Canning, is the way she meets Abilene Armitage, who literally, like, she's chucked out on the street and, you know, Imp happens to be walking past and just picks her up and takes her home.
Yep.
Just the way she just picks up Eva Canning, who's, you know, if you read one interpretation of the ghost story in the book, has been walking up and down a stretch of highway at different times naked for 40 years.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, waiting for somebody to with a perception
to see her up. To see her
and then bring her home. And Abilene being appalled that you would just pick up this person and bring her back.
She could be a crazy person.
And yet, you know, she brought Abilene back. And, you get this, the opening of their relationship and what it might be like and how it's evolved. It's really captivating stuff. It's really lovely.
It absolutely is. And I think – I know when we talked about The Red Tree last year, and I said at that time there was a lot of little autobiographical things, because having followed Caitlin's online journal for many years, I could see a lot of the little autobiographical things. And Ian, at the time, you said something like, oh, is there? Oh, I find that a bit disappointing, actually.
Did I say that?
Yeah, no, you did. You were just saying, you – so much more impressive. It had just all come out of her head. That probably weren't your exact words, but that was the feeling, right? You didn't like to think that some of this was based on her life. You like to think
I'll take
that
your
she
word
just
for it, Kirsten.
Imagined it.
Yes,
but and I think that's a lot of, and you know, I mean, if that's one way you come to reading a text, another way is I got a lot of enjoyment out of seeing the autobiography. And I think I'm gonna talk about gender for a little bit because
please don't. You say it like, you know, just to warn you all in advance.
It just seems like it always comes back to this.
Because this is central. Gender is central to this book.
Yes, it is.
I might be shitty if we didn't talk about gender.
Yeah, but when we're talking about and I will say that I see this conversation happen a lot more in literary fiction than in genre fiction, though I do see it occasionally in genre fiction. Hi, Kat Valenti. when a male author does something metafictional like this and uses their life and creates art from their life and weaves themselves, and I'm not necessarily saying Caitlin did this with The Drowning Girl, but when autobiography becomes a part of that, that's received in quite a different way to when a female author does
How?
It. Well, it's
That sounded more accusing than I meant it to.
It did sound a bit accusing. How? Explain yourself. Offer examples and footnotes.
Yes.
Young lady.
Kirsten, how?
Well, it's seen as a position of strength for a male author to do that. It's seen as you know, an imaginative leap, as something really clever, as something that contributes to our idea of what literature is and how literature works and how life and art intersect.
And when a woman does it,
it's seen as, well, she's just writing her life, isn't she? Anyone could do that. It's easy. And I will give you a genre example.
Okay.
Reason I mentioned Kat Valenti was because she published, and now I can't remember the name of the short story, but she published a short story on, was it Clark's World? It was a website, an online online magazine a couple of years ago, and it was a story that was about a science fiction writer. And it brought in a lot of mythology, and it was actually kind of a novella. She read it at Continuum when she was a guest of honor.
Okay.
I just thought you might have heard that.
Yes,
I will look up the name and put it in the show notes. But the point is, she wrote this, and she wrote this novella about a science fiction writer on in the US and all this stuff. And part of it was incorporated bits of her biography, and part of it didn't. It was a fictional retelling, and that the comments in that kind of slammed her for A, calling it science fiction, B, for incorporating biography when that's not fiction, let alone science fiction, for all this stuff, and basically saying, well, you didn't really write a story. You didn't write fiction. You just wrote about your life. That's not a story. That's just – and she – No, she wrote this amazing story and she used some postmodern metafictional components to write this story. And I think authors, male or female, who use that, who can take the events of their life, and they're not just writing a diary, they are using the events of their life and they're working them into fiction. I think that's a legitimate form, just as much as writing something that's purely made up. But I think male authors tend to get more credit for doing that.
I haven't seen it, and that might be because I'm gender blind on this issue. I think that's the term.
Gender blind
on this issue. I just haven't seen.
Is that like colour blind?
Yes. Well, I am colour blind.
It's
so
like
yeah.
both there.
So I have both. I just haven't seen it in the way you have. I mean, look, I'm not asking you for footnotes and that. I'll take your word.
The author who wrote "The Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit,"
Jeanette Winterson.
Yes, Jeanette Winterson. Her latest, and "Oranges Are the Only Fruit" was a had biographical elements.
Yeah.
It was also, but great it was book. Fiction. Yeah. It was fiction, right? But there was a lot of biography in there. And her,
that's why she's writing a memoir.
The latest book that's come out has done that again, and it's like re-examined that story. But again, I mean, I just get the feeling.
Yeah, but I don't think she's been slammed for it.
She's not. It's being regarded as lesser work. It's being regarded as lesser work, and I think if someone like Bret Easton Ellis does it, in Luna Park, it's regarded as incredibly clever and incredibly important.
Really?
Yes.
I must have missed that with Luna Park because I read Luna Park and I don't know how incredibly important it felt. That was me.
That's it.
I will happily take your word for it as well. I'm tempted to sort of say, well, give me an example of a male writing this and where it's been applauded. Because, you know, that's the kind of
thing. Well, there's Bret Easton Ellis and there's John Franzen.
That's what the white guys say. They say, show us a script.
I will say the comments on the Valenti story and everything like that are obviously stupid bullshit. And
they are, but
lazy, shorthanded ways of looking. And I was thinking as you're talking, I was thinking, well, I can sort of see a cultural shorthand that says, for a man to expose his inner feelings is a braver, more courageous thing to do than for weak, touchy, feely girls to get all weak, touchy, feely.
Yeah.
So I could sort of see that. I can. I have to say, this is such a fucking brave, courageous book that it would be appalling to see something like that said of it, because this plainly was a raw. I mean, irrespective of just having read her writing about it, it's plainly a really raw book.
Oh, yeah, fuck yeah.
This thing would have hurt to do, even if metaphorically. But I mean, like, this was wrenched out. Yeah, this wasn't just kind of blip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it would be specious and stupid to suggest that there was anything weaker about it, because there may or may not be some correspondence to Caitlin Kinnan's life, because Caitlin Kinnan
because Abilene's a gamer. Abilene's a gamer, and you go, well, that's just come right out of her bloody role playing game stuff on her blog, and she just plunked it on a character. And how simple's that? You know, I mean, if that's the sort of shit that that people start to write about, well, again, like the people who talk about is this genre or not, they should be put up against the same wall and mowed down,
because there's a craft. I mean, I'm saying that that's part of art. I mean, take. I don't care what you're writing. Every word you ever write has come from your experience. Now, whether that is like your experience in stuff you've lived or people you've talked to or research you've done, it is something that you have taken into yourself and turned into fiction. And I do get a little frustrated with people who, in the same way that I get frustrated with literary people who shit on genre fiction because, oh, it's just imagination and doesn't have any bearing to real life. I do get really frustrated with people who will look down at mimetic fiction and fiction withdraws from biography and say, well, that's just, you know, anyone could do that. That's just writing about real life. We've got imagination, because it's all imagination. And no writer who's worth their salt and writes work that's worth reading simply sits down and writes a freaking biography. That's not exciting. You know, I mean, you take things, even if you're writing something that's heavily autobiographical, if you're not writing an autobiography, if you're writing fiction, you are doing something with that. You are creating art with that.
So we're all furious agreement about this.
I think we are.
I just want to also say that, I mean, we've got to get to the end of it, but I really responded to the conversation between Imp and Abilene about Abilene's transgender status and how Imp was trying to draw parallels between, I think it was the transformation of her worldview and what it had been for how much she admired Abilene's transformation.
Yeah.
And Abilene going, well, sort of, no, you really are completely misunderstanding it. This is not a transformation. This is an affirmation of what I actually am.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
And that was a really powerfully stated and clearly stated kind of thing about an area which a lot of people are really unclear and confused about. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I don't think it's – irrespective of bias and prejudice and all that, all of which is important, but irrespective of it, it's a challenging thing to try to understand that someone could look at themselves and see such a dichotomy between their perceptions of themselves and what they see that they have to take steps to physically change that. And I wouldn't attempt – there are things that occur to me. I wouldn't even – attempt to disrespect it by drawing other parallels.
Yeah.
But it's just really powerful and clear and integral as well to both of these characters and how they interact and how they see the world. And it is probably one of the key sort of – I mean, we talk about this being about gender, and it fundamentally is. But the least interesting part about it is the character's a gay. In yes. some ways, it's like
yeah,
yeah. It's this other stuff that comes in,
and the transgender stuff is also other stuff that comes in. Yeah,
it is, but it's also. I mean, there's not a lot of experience. I mean, maybe I just don't read in the right places, but there's not a lot of really powerful, clear, intelligent writing about the internal perceptions of a transgender person about why they do this thing.
Yes,
and I mean, and Abilene talks very, very briefly about the extent to which she's been. We're thrown out of her family. They don't love her anymore. And I think they both puzzle over, I mean, how can parents decide not to love their kid
yep.
just because they don't fit some shape? And I think it's a real – it's one of the great emotional strengths of the book.
Yeah.
It has this in it. And it's integral.
I think it's interesting, Jonathan, when you say – you might just not be reading in the right places because you don't come across this stuff. Mm. Because I mean, there's a lot of writing about that
yeah.
in and out of fiction, but it doesn't tend to be published in mainstream in mainstream fiction. So you do sort of have to go and find it, I guess. And what's I think the character of Abilene is I think she's beautifully drawn, and it's funny also because when you were saying before you didn't quite get. How Imp and Abilene, like why they got together and what caused that, but and yet you believe the relationship.
Yes, very much.
Like that didn't.
But then that's how relationships decree.
Exactly, right? So yeah, you don't need to be given this laundry list of why no. each of them decided they liked each other. It's enough for Kiernan to write this relationship so that it's believable.
Mm. But aside from that affirmation stuff you were talking about, the transgendered stuff's normalised.
It is normalised, but and that's the problem. I mean, not with this book. Sorry, that sounded really bad. The problem is that this is such a rare example of that,
yes.
And usually in books that make it across to mainstream fiction, if there is a chance. Transgender character. Often if there's a character who's gay, the book's about that. And if it's not about that, at least their subplot is about that. And it is really rare, I think, in mainstream fiction. And by mainstream, I'm not talking about genre versus literary. I'm talking about stuff that's just on the bookshelves in a bookshop and not on the, you know, gay/queer shelves. To have a character who just happens to be transgender or just happens to be a lesbian, and that is part of who they are, and it's not sidelined as part of their character, and it's talked about when it comes up, but it's not the plot, it's not central to the plot. Bad things don't happen to them because they're transgender
yep.
or lesbian,
yep, exactly.
And it's really, really rare. And you know, as much as I think the portrayal of Abilene is, I mean, she's a great character in this book. All the more so because she's not on screen very often, and yet I've got such a clear picture of who she is. I think she's a representation of a transgender woman, and I think for there to be a clearer picture of what transgender is, it can't just be Abilene.
No,
we just have to have more of this.
Yeah.
So more of this, please.
Yes. And on that note, because I don't have anything more to say.
No, I think we all really recommend this book.
For my money, if in 2013 in Brighton, this book is not on the World Fantasy Award ballot, I will think substantially less of the World Fantasy Awards and the World Fantasy Awards jury that year. It would be a profound injustice.
Absolutely.
What about things like the Nebula? I'm not saying the Hugo because I sort of give that.
It's not a Nebula book.
Around this book.
Really? Because this is because the Nebula is not just SF.
It leans more towards science fiction, doesn't it?
Sure.
It shits me that this book can only really go on one award thing. The Shirley Jackson would probably have it.
The
Tiptree.
The Tiptree, absolutely.
Oh, yes, this is a front runner.
I would be surprised to see it on the Hugo or the Nebula just because they tend to be closer to the center of genre kind of awards. They tend to go for more clear, straight plots and resolutions and everything. This is not the kind of book that I would necessarily – it could do. The Nebula is more likely to do it than the Hugo.
So you're not going to have a ballot which will have 23-12 and this – on the Hugo ballot.
I would be surprised. Whereas I'd expect to see 23-12 on the Hugo ballot, for example.
Yeah.
But this, if I didn't see this on the World Fantasy, if I didn't see it on the Shirley Jackson, if this fucking book is not on the Tiptree Award, they can all pack up, go home, eat their bloody cake at home, and just stop the fuck bothering people. This is the sort of book they should fucking recognise, or there's no point in them existing.
I think it would be very unlikely for it not to make
on the list. The Tiptree. We're not saying it should win the Tiptree.
Oh no, because awards are idiosyncratic. Also, like the actual winners are. But I genuinely believe that. I think actual winners are that just really comes down to judging panels ballots on the day.
Well, we're talking about the
actual lists are what
it's got to be a fucking walk up for the World Fantasy and the Shirley Jack. Got to be.
Oh, the Shirley,
But the Tiptree first.
I've got to say.
Yes, absolutely. On their long list if it doesn't win. Absolutely.
This book is when I think of the Shirley Jackson Award and the writer it's named after, I'm hard pressed to think of a better book I've read in the last 5 years.
They should be sending this to the National Book Award people.
Oh, fuck yes.
They should be sending it to all those kind of places.
The Pulitzer look at these?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know the mechanism for that. But this is a book which deserves to be seen as a significant work of literature.
It
deserves its framing within genre as much as it's earned its framing outside of that as well.
Absolutely. I think this is a – it reminds me a little of House of Leaves, which we will be talking about at the end of the year, only in the sense that it is one of those books, and I don't know that it's gotten the traction that House of Leaves got, possibly because Kiernan has come from genre, whereas Danielewski didn't. But it is very much that. It is a book that is a book about as much about the people telling the story and piecing together the story as it is about the story. And the experience of reading it is fluid and somewhat arbitrary. But it is. It could sit right near that book. And that book has become a cult classic and has sold millions of copies. And The Drowning Girl should have that status. And
we're halfway through the year. I haven't read anything like this.
I would defy you to sit there and tell me that you've read much like this.
Yeah, full stop.
This book is itself. I don't expect to read another book like it. I wouldn't expect that Blood Oranges that Caitlin's working on or anything else
is going to be more fun.
Whatever the next substantial series work she does is. Alabaster is not like that. The comic series which I've been reading, that's kind of
Dempsey books.
I have to say, I fucking love the Alabaster graphic novel stuff she's doing. It's great. But it deserves to be, it's weirdly actually, I think, okay, it's a work of outsider art in many ways.
Yes.
But I think it's actually more, in my mind, applicable to mainstream than even the Danielewski book, which is all kinds of, it plays all kinds of typographical tricks and that kind of crap, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. This doesn't do that. This is just about trying to communicate the nuances of ambiguity as honestly as you can.
That should have been put on the book. That is a beautiful tagline. That is exactly what it is doing.
But it is a book that I think will lend itself to multiple readings. And it is a kind of book that people will puzzle over. I really do hope this, and it may take a little time to get traction. I don't know. I mean, the House of Leaves book seemed to just take off almost as soon as it was published.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to it.
But and this hasn't, which I think is a real shame. But yeah, I think this.
Well,
this
we don't know how much it's sold.
Is a remarkable.
It's only been out for 3 or 4 months, but we don't know how much.
Yeah, I know, but I think it's a remarkable book.
And yes, I agree.
It's yeah. just.
All right. And,
yes.
Yes. Good.
I was about to say, I don't expect to read a better book in 2012 than this.
Well, then, Jonathan, if you're saying that, it's a fucking crime that it doesn't appear on a Hugo. Because what the fuck are those awards for?
But they're
for
different.
That community to recognise what they like and appreciate.
Oh yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. And if you want it to be on there, you should vote for it. Which I
okay. Care. We're almost going to be going longer than Galactic Suburbia last week, so let's wrap it up.
Okay, so next week tomorrow night for episode 22,
breaking the fourth wall.
Oh whatever. Our guests tomorrow night in their hotel room.
You won't hear it tomorrow night, listeners, unless of course you're just backing those all up and.
Yeah.
Playing them off.
You won't listen to it until. Actually, when we listen to. When's this one going to be
on? This is July.
Oh, yeah. Hi, July. Yeah.
Hi,
why
July.
Are we even having this conversation? Yeah. So, tomorrow night, which will be August for people who are listening to this, we're having Angela Slater and Lisa L. Hannett on the show.
Yes.
Now, we've done something a bit different with those two. Rather than what the hell we did here was just three books, which we're never doing again, by the by.
Yeah.
We are getting.
We're doing four books.
Yeah. Because we're trying to break through. We're trying to what did Charles Tan want us 4 hours? We're trying to break.
Yeah,
that
we're
record.
Trying to break the 4 hour record.
By the way, Charles, this episode. He'll love this episode because it's and me on at the same time. The two books we're doing are Voice of the Fire by Alan Moore, that was recommended by Angela, and Galore by Michael Crummy, which is recommended by Lisa. So only those two books. We didn't recommend any. And it is Michael Crummy, isn't it, Kirsten?
Yes, it's Michael Crummy.
Yep, Crummy.
So you'd be in and out in 20 minutes if you really work at it.
Absolutely. We'll say, yeah, hi, Angela.
We are doing an Alan Moore book, so
yeah,
possibility unlikely.
And there's a lot of crunch to galore as well. Anyway, should I just get straight to feedback?
Yes.
All right, because John needs to go to bed, so do I. Yeah, okay, I've got to work tomorrow, Jonathan, so don't give me the whole shrug of the shoulder crap.
So wrap it up. Feedback on Twitter,
which I've noticed more people following, writer and critic. Comment at the website at writerandcritic.podbean.com, which we don't get much of, but, you know, try. Email at writerandcritic@gmail.com and 5 stars on iTunes, please. We are getting a few more of those.
If you like us, obviously.
Oh, why put the caveat in? Just let it be. Jonathan, it has been an astonishingly great, fantastic pleasure. First off, you recommended a great book. We didn't tear it to pieces, which is not a first, but getting there.
It's rare.
Rare. And you said some really smart things, which not I should be sound surprised, but because I'm
you
used to it.
You sounded a little surprised.
A little. I am. Let's just say, I think you've actually brought your A game tonight.
Oh, well, thank you.
Aww. Yeah, that's what I think. Kirsten.
You're very patronising.
Fuck off. Kirsten, fuck off. And I always think you bring your A game. See, I swore, but praised.
Thank
swore,
you.
But praised.
It's been a great pleasure getting to do this with you both.
Yes, thank you very much for coming all the way across from Perth just for us. Are you doing anything else while you're here?
No, nothing at all. I mean, it's July.
It's July, so, you know.
Are you really on a panel about what happened to space opera or was it hard SF? Or yeah, okay.
I think he was on the panel.
That
it's
knock.
The future.
Sorry. That knock was Jonathan shooting himself.
All right.
Yeah,
we're out of here.
Okay. See
Bye.
Ya. Bye.
Bye. I know so much more than you do about some stuff that I could tell you about later.